House Resources meeting to order. President Representative Tuck, Kawasaki, Wilson, Co-Chair Newman, and Chair Johnson. And so that everyone knows what we're going to be doing today, we're going to take up House Bill 217. This is a bill that we heard previously. There is a CS, so we will deal with that. And I think we've had a lot of discussion on it. As soon as we kind of get a take on what the CS does, we will hopefully we can take a vote and get that moved out. Representative Newman, are you going to present this or staff?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Johnson.
And before you get started, Representative Olson and Seaton have joined us.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Johnson. And because of some questions that were raised in the last time we heard this, as to about how tax rates are affected and credits and such.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Could we, I'd like to go ahead and move the CS.
Okay.
Would you wait for the motion there, Representative Kawasaki?
I would like to move the CS for House Bill number 217, version R, before us for discussion.
There is objection. Representative Kawasaki, would you like to speak to your objection?
I just want to know what the difference is between the new work draft we just received.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Representative Newman, you can do it from here if you'd like.
Okay. Yeah, the differences are, Representative Kawasaki through Chair, is because of some questions that were raised earlier about identifying the tax credits. Dan Secker, the young man who works for Revenue, did some really fine work and modeled it out. And they worked together with Mr. Bullock to work on the issues. And basically what happened is because of some credits available under ACES with this 5%, they added an either-or clause to make sure it acted to the best benefit. And so that's how one sentence came 8 pages long, but it's basically the same sentences that are changed under each paragraph in preceding statutes. And they can explain the changes down there, but to explain them, I think we have to have a document.
That's correct. So that'll be the changes. Representative Kawasaki, I'd like to go ahead and you still maintain your objection?
We're going to hear about this bill.
We're going to hear about this bill. We're not going to pass it out until we've heard. There'll be plenty of discussion, but I would like to move on and use this as a working document so that we can be talking substantively instead of theoretically.
Sure. Okay. I'll draw my
any additional objection? The objection has been moved, so we will be working with the committee substitute for House Bill number 217. It's designated 26LS0816R Bullock, date 2-8-10. Does everybody have that? So that is our working document now, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And House Bill 217, again, which is an act which reduces the production tax for gas that's manufactured in the state of Alaska. This does not affect Cook Inlet gas. It's outside of that. For an attempt to try and induce manufacturing in the state of Alaska to create jobs. And I know that we've talked to many of the members here, and our support for creating jobs is very real here. And is this the only thing that's going to make this happen? No. But this is a step to show a direction to industry and to have a good topic of discussions, I think, on some of the proposals that we are looking forward to further discussion on. I've been working on some gas to liquid stuff for manufacturing. Again, I want to make sure that manufacturing is known as a chemical change in the gas or the methane. This is not LNG export. That's just a cooled and compressed type of process. This is a molecular change to make primarily some fissiotropes or alternative fuels. Works in coordination with work that Siri's doing, with the same gasifying type effect, and work that they're doing up in the Fairbanks area.
So Representative, could you speak up a little bit? We're having a little bit of...
I'll try and get a little closer to the mic here, Mr. Chair. Is that okay? So we're here to answer questions about that. Again, this is another bill to try and induce industry here to create some jobs.
Where was that coming from? Any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before you start, Representative Gutenberg has joined us. And if anyone's got a cell phone on, I'd appreciate you turning it off. And we also, out of respect for fellow members, you don't have to respect me as chairman, but out of respect for fellow members, if we could keep the conversations in the audience to a minimum, it would be greatly appreciated. I'm hard of hearing enough as it is without the extra noise. That's the word I'm looking for. Representative Seaton, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've adopted the CS, but I'm...
That's correct.
...unfamiliar. I mean, I don't understand the difference between the CS, the language in the CS, and exactly what it accomplishes. And if you could explain that, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Newman.
You bet, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask Mr. Don Bullock to come up from Ledge Legal, and he can help go through this.
Mr. Bullock, please join us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Before we start, Representative Seaton, were you here for the first hearing? I don't recall.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'd forgotten if you were...
Mr. Chairman, I think I'd ask the questions.
Okay, right. And so, Mr. Bullock, would you go through the changes and point out the differences to Representative Seaton and myself?
Right, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Donald Bullock. I'm one of your attorneys in Legislative Legal Services, and I'm the drafter of this bill. If you look at the last section of the bill that starts, or the next to last section that starts on page 9, line 31, that was 317 or 217 before this CS, which was a change in the definition of used in the state. And that used in the state definition was relevant to what is currently AS 43.55.0110, which sets a maximum tax rate on gas that's produced and used in the state. After some discussion, the sponsor asked for a CS that instead of requiring the cap to be applicable to gas that's used in the state, that producers have an option to apply the cap or just have gas used in the state taxed at the regular rate applicable to other gas, no matter where it's used. And as I understand it, the reason is in AS 43.55.0110, it says that gas that's subject to the cap has to have the credits applied before the cap is applied. So the credits that were applied to gas used in the state could not be available against other production. And what this bill does, provides a new section in section 4 of the bill, a new section to AS 4355. And this section provides for an election that a producer could make to either have the gas tax that's used in the state just as any other gas or have the cap applied. If they make the election in section 4 of the bill, then it's just like 43.55.0110. The cap on gas used in the state is the same as the cap on gas that's produced in Cook Inlet. Because this is a new section that provides for the cap, most of the bill just corrects cross-references to the section and replaces a reference to the cap in AS 43.55.0110 to the new section, which is 43.55.014. So the change in the CS is rather than having the cap applicable to all gas used in the state, producers have an option to go for the cap that's currently in AS 43.55.0110 through the enactment of this new section, or just have gas used in the state taxed as any other gas that's taxed without regard as to where it's used.
Representative Seaton, you have a follow-up?
I guess I have a question. What this section means and how it applies, because maybe it's not for Mr. Bullock, but at some point I would like to pose the question so that the appropriate person could answer it, Mr. Chairman, if that...
Thank you, Representative Seaton. I suggest you pose the question. We'll try to find the appropriate person.
Okay, that's fine. And my question is, at what point someone can make this selection, and can a company that is having a major development take the tax credits and the tax write-offs against all of their upstream expenses and tax credit on the development at the high rate and offset that against their oil, and then once gas starts flowing, make this selection and then have their gas tax at a very low rate. And in that case, what we would be doing is having a situation that I could foresee where we are spending 60 or 70% of the development costs, we are offsetting with our tax credits and deferrals, and then when production comes, they would tax at 5%, and the state's hanging out there and would never recover. Even if they had great gas production, we would never recover our, you know, our offset. So that's the question, and I don't know who would be the proper.
We have Gary Rogers with the tax division on the line. Representative Newman, you want to take a shot at that, or you want to leave that to the try to get Mr. Rogers to?
We can leave that to Mr. Rogers, but my first indication, the thought process is done, is a lot of that's already done, you know. And basically, with 217, it's just adding manufacturing to the end of that. And so what happened is, because of the 5% or the 17.7% tax rate available for equipment, which this section does, that's what that is. How it can be applicable to other tax rates, but we can have Mr. Rogers do it, or Dan Stickle here.
Mr. Rogers, did you understand or hear the question?
Mr. Chairman, I heard part of the question. I did not hear the whole question.
Would you restate that? And also, and I'll identify you this time, Gary Rogers with the tax division. So, Representative Seaton, would you restate that for Mr. Rogers?
Yes, and the concern here is looking at a major production and a major usage of gas, and whether under this bill a producer could use the existing tax credits and tax deductions based on progressivity and all, where we might be paying 70%. The state of Alaska would be offsetting with credits and deductions maybe up to 70% of the expenses going into the entire production. And then when gas is flowing to a major manufacturing plant, could then select to have it taxed at Cook Inlet rate, in which we would have the limit, you know, of the 5% of 2006. And so my question is, if that's available under the wording the way we have, would we ever be able to recover, even at that tax rate, the investment that the state of Alaska puts into that development that was credited and deducted under the upstream provisions of ACES?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, thank you for restating the question. A lot of the answer to that would depend on each individual producer's circumstances, but in general, that's a good question, and I don't have the answer for that right now.
Chair.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe with working with Mr. Bullock here, if that election's made, then all rules applicable to AS 4355-011-0 apply to the cap on gas used in state, and if the election is not made, the gas is taxed at the other tax rate. That's what this does. It's that either or rate. And Mr. Bullock can maybe explain that further. But
Mr. Chairman, basically what this bill does is that it just allows a taxpayer to opt to use what is currently AS 4355.0110, or to not have the gas subject to the limitations. That are also that, and that limitation comes with requirements of how the credits are applied.
And let me see if I can cut to the chase just a second. I guess the question is, can you do both? Is it an either or? Is it an and? Once you make an election, can you change? To cut it to simple terms, that's what we're looking at. Once you made a selection, are you then at that point be able to go back and pick and choose a better rate based upon your tax credit? Or once you've decided to take it at the 5%, are you stuck with that? And stuck with that's not the right. That's your choice, and you live with that. Or do you have the ability to move back and forth depending on flow and everything else, I guess, would be the question. Does that sum it up?
That does, and the reason is because, you know, Point Thompson's a great example, because we have a large gas development Right now, we have a major contribution by the state of Alaska because of the 20% tax credit, and we have the upstream tax of 25% plus progressivity. So we, you know, at $70 a barrel, we may be putting in 70% of the total investment into that field. And after gas starts flowing with a large-scale pipeline coming to either the North Slope or South Central, where the gas would be used in manufacturing, could at that time, when gas starts flowing from that field that we have primarily financed and built, could then the tax rate be selected of the Cook Inlet 5% for the manufacturing of this large plant, and then we would basically, I don't think we would ever recover our investment. And that's, so exactly the question that you were talking about is timing, and can you utilize one and then at a later date make the other selection.
You've been demoted. Mr. Bullock.
There's a little disconnect in the bill. Under AS 4355014C in section 4 of the bill, the election is made annually at the time the return for the production tax is filed. However, the next section talks about making the estimated payments during the year. It would be based on what their projected tax would be if they made the election. So it 4355014 could be amended in C to say they make the election at the time the first estimated payment is due for the tax for the year, rather than waiting until the end of the year to claim it.
Representative Seaton.
And my problem with this is that most of the investment in the development of the field and exploration and development and all that takes place before gas ever flows. And so if this is an annual election, it would let an oil company write off at maybe 70%. The state would be investing in the field at 70% of the total expenses, and then annually when the gas starts to flow, they could elect 5% tax rate. And so I see that as something that we just need to guard against. And though that may be a provision in the fuel and electrical generation portion, and this is adding manufacturing, I think that manufacturing, in addition to those other two, is what's going to be utilizing or could utilize significant amounts of gas, much more than fuel usage for residences and those things. So my worry is that we're looking at possibly, if we don't have an export market, then all of the gas would be this way. We would be the major investor, and we would receive very little in tax.
Mr. Bullock, let me ask you a question. If we took out the manufacturing aspect of this, do we still have that problem?
Mr. Chairman, the manufacturing expands the definition of gas used in the state to manufacturing, which it does not do now. So what that does is that it expands the market for the gas that could be used in the state. So that, in turn, then expands the amount of gas that would be subject to an election to have the cap applied. But I also want to point out that the credits under the production tax in AS 43.55.023 through 025 aren't affected by this bill. They would still be generated as they always are. So the effect of this bill is it expands the gas, the volume of gas that could be used in the state, by providing more purposes for that are allowed as to be subject to what is now a cap, and under the bill would be subject to the election.
Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, the point is that the purpose of this bill is to expand the amount of gas and maybe, hopefully, in large measure, expand the amount of gas that we would be selling. It's not quite tax-free, but it's very low tax rate. And if we're giving all of the credits, which are available through the other provisions, and we're allowing upstream deductions of the 25% plus progressivity, It's one of those things where we're going to have a lot of money invested and get very little back. And we're going to get manufacturing back, but manufacturing is not going to pay the bills, and so that's my worry.
Thank you. Representative Seaton, I think this is one of those policy calls, do we want to trade taxes for jobs? And that's a call we're going to have to make. Maybe we don't. Maybe that's the policy we decide to go with. I mean, and that's really what you're talking about. And sometimes we will make that decision as a body to sacrifice one for the other, put money in the private sector or not. That's a policy call that I think we have to deal with. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bullock, on page 3, line 26, this says that they make that election at the time the return is due, and you mentioned that maybe we should make it earlier than that. I would like to hear your comments on it.
As you probably remember from dealing with ACES and the PPT, that it changed the tax from what was a monthly tax before to an annual tax. And at the same time, it provided for monthly installments. And so in AS 4355.020, which is amended and starting in section 5, it provides for the calculation of an installment payment that's roughly equal to a 12th of what the tax liability will be due for the year. And there was a provision in 020A already that applied to gas used in the state and how to determine the cap for the and how that cap affects the installment payment. So my suggestion was that since they make the installment payments during the year as the gas is produced, but they wouldn't elect it until after the end of the year, that it probably could be made during the year at the time an installment payment was made. Now again, what they have to know is whether it's used in the state or not. And if there's no manufacturing facility, the gas that will be going to the manufacturing facility isn't used in the state right now until there is that facility and the gas is delivered. So that's one of the things the producer has to look at. Is this gas used in the state? And so it also applies to the question Representative Seaton had, is that the credits that are accruing are going to be applying to other production until this used in the state kicks in because the market's brought it.
Representative Wilson, follow-up, or are you?
Not right now.
Okay, Representative Newman, you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to respond a little bit about some of the questioning that's been going on here. First off, you know, as Mr. Bullock first started out in his comments, what 217 does is provide for the opportunity for Alaska's gas. Hopefully we'll have lots of gas that we're producing, creating lots of jobs to be able to use in different ways for manufacturing. Right now, Alaska's gas is used for home heating and electrical generation primarily. So we're trying to allow it to be used for manufacturing. Hopefully we can make that happen and create thousands of jobs in the state. That's the goal. There was an issue identified by revenue. We tried to fix that in 217. And that's what we did. And so because of the election with the either or, because some of the questions raised by Representative Seaton earlier, that's exactly what happened. Is assistance with Mr. Stickle there, identifying these. And if you look at some of the fiscal notes that were coming here, this is a zero fiscal note. You know, right now, we're producing no gas for manufacturing. And when you talk about how much value to the state has, ours, our value rate to the state is zero. We're getting nothing. I mean, so I guess to me, 5% is more than nothing. And besides, production taxes is just one of the, you know, we still have lots of other areas where taxes are used in job creations with corporate taxes and royalties and all that other stuff. So it's kind of trying to help incentivize that along with more manufacturing and more development processes and production. So I think that the opportunity to have this is good. You know, my goal is to try and be able to have a pipeline to South Central to some manufacturing. This, I think, will maybe assist with large diameter pipelines out there. If that happens, it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But we have to do everything that we can do right now to try and help establish that. And Mr. Chair, you hit the nail right on the head. You know, my goal is to try and create jobs in this state, and revenue, I know, is important. It's an important part of what we do, and I know Representative Seaton's concerns about revenue to the state and paying our bills. But if we're creating more manufacturing, those manufacturers also pay corporate taxes. And they're also helping, you know, if we've got down in line going where they're buying different permits and royalties. And so there's a lot of different things you can continue to add on there for diversifying our economy at a time when Trans-Alaska Pipeline is going down throughput and our cost of government's going up. We need to find ways to diversify our economy. That's my goal here. I know I kind of went on.
Representative Newman, this doesn't necessarily say this could be a Fairbanks manufacturing plant as well.
This could
this
be
is
anywhere.
Anywhere we use manufacturing. This is not limited. It could be for mining or anything out there anywhere in the anywhere in Alaska in state.
If the gas is manufactured, which again means a molecular change, it's not an LNG export, or if it's used for home heating or electrical generation.
Okay. Representative Seaton, anything
yes.
else? You look inquisitive.
No, well, and I guess I'm trying to look at the or trying to look at this in the terms of we have been counting on gas as the replacement, as Representative Newman said, as oil goes down. If we pass this and the larger pipeline comes into, stays inside the state and we use it all for manufacturing, and I don't care whether it's Agrium or GTLs, which I've supported or whatever, we are basically saying we will get no revenue off of that gas. And I say no revenue because the tax credits and the upstream amounts will probably fully offset any amount of tax we get. So when I'm looking at jobs, I'm also looking at saying, okay, we're not going to have forward funding of education, we're not going to have a number of other things because our tax base that we're counting on as oil goes down, we have just allowed, if the manufacturing comes in, we've allowed that to have almost a zero tax base. I mean, that's basically, Cook Inlet is a extremely low tax rate, and that's why we've had some Anchorage has had the lowest gas prices in the nation for a long, long time. And that's good in a way, but we have to either substitute another tax regime to on something else, whether it's income tax or sales tax or mining taxes or something else.
We can tax those manufacturers.
That's right. We can tax those manufacturers, and we can say you get cheap gas, and now we're going to tax it back by raising. But
wouldn't that be a pleasant decision to make, that we have those funding sources out there, and we're not talking blue skies, but we're talking about people manufacturing, creating jobs. And like I said, it's a policy call. It's what we have to, it's a decision we have to make.
And my only question is whether we're giving the incentives to the right people. This is a production tax. It doesn't even go to the manufacturer. If we were wanting to have manufacturing use of gas, we would do a credit to manufacturers that use gas as a feedstock, and then we're actually giving credit and encouraging the manufacturer instead of giving a tax, low tax rate on the producers and hoping that they pass those lower costs on to someone that's using gas. So that's my problem, and that's.
And I certainly understand that. Any additional?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out that in 4355014, this only applies to a period before 2022. So it has an end period for the election to apply. And it's in statute, and as it goes forward, you can see how it works. And as the legislature, you can adjust the statute to your best judgment.
Okay. Representative Newman, okay. Before you go, Representative Gutberg, was this on this topic or are you going into a different area before they
respond?
Yeah,
a little bit different.
Okay.
So
Representative Newman.
On this topic, because it's my concern too, because we do, this would lower the production tax, but there's also corporate taxes that are paid, there's royalties that are done, there's local property taxes, there's leases and permits that are purchased from the state, and Representative Seaton, where House Bill 217 says it's used as feedstock. So again, I think that's specifically states that, and that's basically what 217 was to start with. It says used as feedstock for manufacturing process.
Yeah. Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came in a little bit late, and I'm sorry about that. I'm one of those people that are predisposed to be on time, but this job kind of rubs up against that.
A lot of our predispositions disappear. I appreciate that.
And perhaps this was answered before. I know at times our tax breaks and our incentives or, don't produce what we think we want. And one example is in logging is cans. You know, at one point we said you can't export logs until they've been milled. And milled, and this happened in the interior, they would run their logs through, cut two sides off, create slab wood, and export the logs export them to Japan. So what, I'm just concerned about this, where you could take gas, take off a minor part of the molecules, and use them someplace else in another process where we would not want them used, where we want, you know, a larger percentage of the gas or all of it for feedstock. I mean, when we talk about a major gas line and the solids and all those things that we want to turn them into products, all the things that we can do, we want them all used here and we don't want them exported. So in the definition of using the gas and the feedstock, creating an end product, well, you could use an end product that's here, but having a higher percentage of the gas, you move on to something else that's unintended. Have you asked the departments or anybody about your concerns for that? I mean, we're certainly always kind of raise our eyes when we have a bill that's one paragraph to 10 pages, and you know, what are we getting into with the unintended consequences? So.
Okay. I mean, to the chair, Representative Gutenberg. Great question, because I hope there's lots of products that we can make out of that. You know, through the fish strokes process, where you're creating not just a transportation fuel, synthetic transportation fuels, but the ethanes are a byproduct of that, which is the feedstocks for plastics. And so the being able to take those gases, separate those molecules, and create different projects and processes throughout the state to have more of added value to everything that we can get. You know, we should be taking our gas and doing everything that we can to it in this state. You know, that's the goal of this, to be able to have the ethanes for the raw plastics, the butanes, propanes where we need propanes, we can be doing synthetic propanes. And these are products that are, the fuels of the future, biodegradable products, safe products. And I could go on for a long time, but, you know, Mr. Chair?
Representative.
If I may. I know that we have some of the commissioners here, and we're working on your bill with 308, and we're not going to have the opportunity to have them later. So I'll make sure that they have time to do their presentations.
Okay.
So out of respect for that, because I believe we're going to have Commissioner Galvin and some of the others here, I want to make sure that they have the opportunities. But I will ask members of the committee to come talk to me, in the meantime, and my staff about this, or Mr. Bullock or Revenue. If they have questions on this, committee time is valuable, like you say, Representative Gutenberg. And I want to make sure that we have opportunity for the commissioners out of respect for the administration. So if you would like, certainly you're the chair, but if you'd like, we can set this aside. I want to make sure that everybody's questions are answered here, but I want to make sure that we get to it. Mm-hmm. But if there's questions in the meantime.
We have this room until 5 o'clock. I don't know how many of the members can stay, but it is my intention, and I don't know, Representative Olson, who has canceled Labor and Commerce.
Yeah, I think we have to thank the Chair of Labor,
thank the Chair of Labor and Commerce to be here as long as it takes to hear.
Thank you.
Hear what's going on. I appreciate that, and I'm going to take up your suggestion because I don't want to cut anyone short. But it's frustrating to me when we make an offer to people to visit with the sponsor. I understand this bill grew from one to several pages. Before the next meeting, it's going to be fairly irritating to me if we don't have that conversation with the sponsor and some of these questions come up. I would encourage you to get them answered beforehand. I certainly want them on the record. I don't want to do anything that's not on the up and up, but I would suggest that you get with the sponsor get the questions at least proposed in a manner that we can put them on the record in a clear, concise manner. Nothing, that's me not being able to do that, not anyone else on the committee. And so that we are ready, the next time we hear this, to take some action up or down. So I would encourage everyone to have those conversations, and let's do that. And with that, Representative Newman, or Mr. Bullock, I'm sorry.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just have one tip for the committee as you go through the bill. And I'm sure you've asked us for bills before, and you've sent us a paragraph, and suddenly you get 5 pages of your bill because of all the cross-references to what you want changed. That was the situation here. So as you go through, if you look where subsection O, 4355-0110, has been deleted, in other words, it's going to be in brackets, before that, you're going to see this new election section referred to as inserted and underlined in bold. So as you go through, you just see that. That's an indication that that section was only amended to provide for the election in the bill that replaces what is now that subsection O.
And anyone who has difficulty like I do interpreting legislation, Mr. Bullock, I'm sure would be happy to give us some instructions on what underlined and bracketed and stuff mean. So I do encourage you to get with the sponsor. Representative Wilson had a question before we move on. And then we're going to move on to the next piece of legislation. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what I just want a simple answer. I don't want anything detailed. I just want a simple answer of why you chose it to do it this way at the production end instead of doing it to the manufacturer so that they would get the benefit, and or is this going to make it so that both do? So I just kind of want to get it in my head where you're coming from before everybody starts talking.
Thank you. To the Chair, Representative Wilson, you know, if you're going to have manufacturing, the cost of your feedstock is going to be a primary driver in that, you know, because that's going to eventually be the cost of your finished product. And so getting that cost of the feedstock get to a rate that's acceptable. And again, and this grew from a couple of sentences to the pages, and most of those pages were it just says only 4 words, an election made under. So it's not like a lot of pages were actually changed, just four words added into there. And that was due to the Department of Revenue went back and they said, under very slight circumstances, maybe there could be a disincentive to the cost of gas for electrical generation and home heating. And if that happened, it could be causing Alaskans to pay more for heating and electrical generation. And so in an attempt to try and reduce their cost, which was the intent of the 17.5 cent rate that was imposed to Cook Inlet, expanded through the state, I said, okay, Revenue, I want to try and help fix that at the same time while we're doing that. If this happens, and you know, if this went this 5% production rate, again, which will have an effect on the cost of feedstock, that could, in very certain circumstances, under like way out there, but there is a chance that that could happen. And so we wanted to make sure that the customers of Alaska had the best opportunity to provide, the lowest cost for home heating and electrical generation. So I wanted to try and fix that at the same time. That's why we're at.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to set this aside. We will bring it up at the nearest or at the next convenient time. Representative Kawasaki.
I was just wondering, Mr. Chairman, whether Division of Oil and Gas and Revenue will be here to answer questions on 217.
I guess we can have them at their next meeting. With the sponsor, and if that's something you'd like to see, Representative Kawasaki.
I have questions about the fiscal note and some questions. We don't have the full fiscal note yet, and there's some things in the fiscal note that I've got questions
about. And we can certainly deal with that at that time.
Okay.
Thank you. With that, Representative, thank you.
Mr. Stickle lives here. He's here full time on this, yeah. If you have questions, Representative.
And I thank everyone for your attendance. So that everyone knows kind of our tentative schedule. On 308 particularly, we will not be hearing 308 on Friday. We will take it back up on Monday, and I think the producers will be before us to answer questions on Monday. Today we have Commissioner of Revenue, Law, Labor, that will be before us, and then the following Wednesday public testimony. And this will thrill everyone. On that Wednesday, we have the room reserved until session the next day.
Sure.
We will vote this up or down. This bill 308, it is not my intention that we take this bill forever, and it occupies, there's a lot of important legislation that's before this committee, and we got more today. We will continue to get more in the future, I'm sure. I'm not going to let this monopolize the time. We're going to have the conversation, and it is my, unless something comes up differently, that is the tentative schedule, that a week from today we will go until we can't go and get this legislation on to the next body or kill it right here. And it will live and die on its own merits. And with that, I do see the commissioner coming in. Don't sit. Commissioner Galvin, I think you're first in the chute. I'd like to welcome you.
Question.
Richard Bettenberg, yes, sir.
And the sponsor of the bill. Is there going to be another CS, or is this the version we're probably going to take?
You know, anytime we amend it, there's a new CS. I'm not married to this one. I do feel like there are probably some minor technical changes that are cleanups, but I don't think there's anything major. The concept of the bill is going to be, but there may be some sections that were not referenced properly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I do have a list of some of that, but you'll have plenty of lead time.
Thank you. Just making sure that you'll give us some leeway if we have amendments in there, the sections that have changed and things like that.
Well, that's why we have the room reserved from Wednesday from 1 o'clock until session the next day, Mr. Representative. Commissioner Galvin, welcome.
Thank you. Just scared the heck out of me talking about reserving the room for an overnighter.
and Commissioner, it is important that we not tie up the committee's time forever. This is an important issue. We're not going to beat this to death, and we're not going to allow it to be drug on and out, and it will live or die by its own merits within the next 7 days to 10 days out of this committee, and then we'll pass it on and let somebody else live with it. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, you know, add my support to the co-chair and our discussions on how we're doing with this. We're getting a lot of requests for bills hearing, yet, you know, we need to continue moving on here. So encourage members to come talk to us, to talk to revenue. Their guys are here. But we all want to try and get down the road. So
yeah, we want everything to be on the record, but we also want to be able to have a smooth process. And Commissioner Galvin, I've taken up your time now. We do have until 5 days, so help yourself. Thank you, Commissioner.
I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to come and speak to you with regard to the bill before us. Today the governor's oil tax amendment bill was read across. I'm going to provide some general comments to kind of frame the issue from our perspective and tie it in with the bill before you. Then I'm going to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Marcia Davis, who's going to walk through a presentation where we're providing some basically analysis of the various sections of the bill and the components that are included in the proposal. And in a couple of the instances, we're going to just compare it to what is in the governor's bill, just to show addressing the similar theme, but in two different ways.
Commissioner, I appreciate that, but I want to deal with the similarities, not the difference, because we haven't noticed the governor's bill, and I don't want to, in any form or fashion, turn this into a hearing on something we haven't noticed. So if you'll strictly deal with the overlaps, I think that would be to keep us out of trouble. We'll be happy to notice the governor's bill in the very near future, and we can deal with that. But I would like to not keep ourselves out of trouble on the noticing and everything else. So let's just deal with the similarities.
Yeah, and that is what we're going to focus on. Okay. We understand that it's the House Bill 308 that's before you now, and that's what we're talking about.
Perfect. Thank you, Commissioner.
And with that, I want to first just commend the sponsor of House Bill 308. I think that the intent behind it, the goal of looking to find a way to increase jobs for Alaskans and production in Alaska is the one that's shared by the governor, by this administration, and we commend you for that effort, and we want to work with you in trying to find the most effective and efficient way to reach that goal. And that's really what we're here to talk about today with regard to this bill, in terms of looking at how does it function from the perspective of the Department of Revenue, how would we implement it, what are some of the issues that we would need to address in order to be able to properly implement it, and then talk a little bit about the trade-offs associated with different ways of trying to accomplish the goal of increasing production and increasing jobs. So what we note is that there are a number of similarities with regard to House Bill 308 and the governor's bill, just noting that both of them deal with providing credits for new drilling activities within existing fields, increasing those credits and increasing the definition. And those are areas that we view as very valuable and favorable. With regard to the local hire provisions that provide an incentive for local hire, increasing the percentage of local hire by providing a tax rebate, again, we support the purpose of that section. We support the idea of trying to maximize Alaska hire in the oil patch. We have always struggled through the history of the state with trying to find ways to deal with that issue with the constraints that are placed upon us by the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution and elsewhere. And we'd like to talk about the issue not so much in terms of that legal side, but just in terms of the mechanism that's provided and the potential behavioral inefficiencies that may result from the way that it's structured, and just kind of lay that out there and talk about it. And then we can decide subsequently how we might see a way to address that. On the progressivity change, we'll talk about that as well. Recognize that it is a section of the bill that is intended to bring the progressivity rate to a level similar to what was in the original ACE's proposal, but just note that there are two significant differences. The first one, which is the most significant, is that the package of the tax that is provided through just this bill, reducing the progressivity, does not put in place what was seen as the trade-off for that reduced progressivity, which was a gross-based floor on the two major fields, that protecting the state's downside, ensuring that the state had revenue at low prices, was the trade-off for the lower take at high prices. When that low price security, when the guaranteed revenue to the state was removed, then the progressivity was supported to go up in order to provide a risk balance that we felt was appropriate given the amount of state credits and participation at the front end of all the new investments. So I just note that was a package when that part of the bill was included in the original proposal. And the second part, just more technical, is that in the original proposal there wasn't the 0.1% escalation beyond the 50% total rate. And we are going to provide you more in the presentation with just from an empirical standpoint, what does that change mean in terms of potential revenue? On the
Commissioner Gowan, just a second. Representative Newman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Pat, when you were talking, I just want to make sure that I was making assumptions here in my mind, but I want to make sure that it's clear that the incentives that you were talking about and in the way that the existing tax structure was developed, that, again, is the cushion of revenue trying to create jobs. And there is a trade-off to revenue, general fund revenues, for whatever. But that's those benefits outweigh the revenue to the state because of other revenues generated beyond that, I'm assuming, in the jobs. That's the intent, correct?
I'm making an assumption, but Representative, the chair, the intent is to create jobs through the investment in oil and gas exploration and development. And the issue for the tax system is what is the way to find not just a balance, but also a structure that maximizes the benefit for the state in terms of the revenue, but also ensures that we have structured it in such a way that we incentivize the investment in new exploration and development. And that's where the question of changing the progressivity comes in. Changing the progressivity will result in, obviously, less money coming to the state, more money staying with the taxpayer, but does it result in new investment? And I think that's what you're going to hear a lot of debate about. From the administration's perspective at this time, given the information that we have received from companies in the industry, there is no commitment to take any tax savings that would result from a lower tax rate and turn it into jobs and investment. There's no commitment. However, with a structure that emphasizes the credits, and again, we applaud the provisions of this bill that provides that increased credit, you end up ensuring that the state benefit, the reduction in the tax, only goes to those who actually are investing and creating jobs in the state. And what you'll see in some of the discussion in a couple of the sections that as we go through the slides, and I'll be here to I'll provide some comments on those, is the issue for the state from a policy perspective. And I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, you talking about the issue sometimes comes down to, are we going to try to increase revenue to the state, or are we going to try to increase jobs in Alaska? And I think that that's a valid question to raise, and I think the analysis comes down in terms of the relative trade-off there. Are we going to forego a significant amount of revenue in order to create a handful of jobs, or are we going to forego a smaller amount of revenue to create a lot more jobs? And that, I think, is one of the crux of the policy questions, and something that you're going to have to try to get out of both the analytical stuff that we can provide you and then perhaps some of the testimony that you can elicit from the people who actually make those decisions. But from a purely analytical standpoint, we can see a direct relationship between providing credits for actual work, resulting in actual jobs, and being able to quantify what that costs the state and be able to provide a rational explanation for why we're doing that, where it becomes a bit more difficult to provide the same linkage between a drop in a tax that just goes back to a company and they get to decide what to do with that investment, and we're merely hoping that they're going to bring it back into the state. And that becomes, for us, a very difficult connection to make, because it really isn't in the actual numbers. And then the last two provisions that we'll talk about is the ones dealing with interest rate, for one. The interest rate provisions have two parts, one being basically a waiver or a lifting of the interest rate application to underpayments of taxes that are due to regulations that are made retroactive. So in other words, because ACES was a fairly complex change in the law, there were a series of regulations that needed to be developed in order to refine for the taxpayer the implementation method and the interpretation method, and that those regs by statute are being made retroactive to when ACES became effective, and in some cases actually retroactive all the way back to when PPT became effective. And they may result in underpayments because, in good faith, a taxpayer made a payment based upon what they thought the tax and what the reg expectation would be, and it was different by the time they actually got put in place at right now, spun back to 2 years. We think it's a we shared the chairman's view that it's probably unfair to tax someone for something that they didn't pay where they didn't know they actually owed it, and that waiving that interest rate is a way to address that particular issue.
Representative Olson?
Are you expecting any lawsuits?
In what nature?
Oh, we're going back that far. I mean, we've seen a number of lawsuits on adjustments to TAPs.
Representative Olson, at this time, we're not aware of any pending lawsuits.
But the regs aren't out yet completely.
Most of the regs are now out. The big one, lease expenditures, was just put out a couple weeks ago. Marcia has the updates on the timings of those. But the one thing that I'll note is we've significantly mitigated the risk of such a lawsuit through the method that we've used to develop those regs. Rather than do something where the typical regulation development process where you send out a draft, take comments, go behind closed doors, and then send out your final, we've had a much more interactive and iterative process that has engaged the industry so that they have seen it develop over the course of the last couple of years, and they've been involved in our analysis of how it will work and what the implications are. And so I see less risk of them feeling as though it was either unfair or surprise or inappropriate for us to have that lag time, because they participated in basically creating that lag time.
Follow up, Representative Olson.
Theoretically, we're not going to see another Amarada Hess come out of this.
we're hopeful. No, we don't expect that.
Thanks.
And Commissioner,
I don't expect either the amount to be that large or the issue.
Yeah, Commissioner, if you'd also kind of go into, it's my understanding that right now we could forgive the tax debt, but we couldn't forgive the penalty under current the interest. We couldn't forgive the interest. Is that
Mr. Chair? That's correct. That the department has the authority and the discretion to waive the penalty for underpayment. However, we do not have discretion as it comes to interest and the application of interest to any underpayment.
Thank you.
And the second part of interest as it relates to House Bill 308 goes to the rate of interest. The bill will significantly reduce the interest rate that's applied to underpayments, and we've got some slides that deal with that issue as well. And then the final piece I'll note is that we're going to talk about what's referred to as the restoring of the three-year statute of limitations for tax issues, and we'll have some comments on the implication of that to the department. So, Mr. Chair, that sort of concludes my general statements. I'll be here to answer questions as we go through. And I'd like to turn it over at this time to Deputy Commissioner Davis to walk you through a presentation on some of our issues associated with the bill.
Before you go, Representative Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the lease expenditure regulations, are the application of those somewhat mitigated or reduced because there was a standard deduction that sunsetted, or either did sunset or it just sunset or will sunset, and so that we didn't have a change in those procedures, or did that not solve any of the problems as far as application of lease expenditures and anticipated lease expenditures?
Representative Stephen, through the chair, I think in general, yes, that if you remember, lease expenditures, the definition of lease expenditures is going to apply to both operating expenditures and capital expenditures, the two kind of components of lease expenditures. The standard deduction, that so-called standard deduction, which expired in December 31st this past year, it basically lack of a better word, froze the allowable lease expenditures on the operating side for Prudhoe Bank Park. Since they're larger fields, larger taxpayer, that would be a substantial portion of any potential change that might come about because of the operation of the lease expenditure. So you're correct in your supposition that it reduced the potential effect of the retroactive application of the regulations. The just to give a sense of scale, the last couple of years, lease expenditures have been fairly evenly split between operating and capital. And so what you would say based on the question is a substantial portion of half of what the lease expenditures define is going to be unaffected from a taxpayer standpoint by the change in the definition.
So follow up. So then as far as the retroactive application, we're really looking at any problems with underpayment or those things that would relate to the CapEx because OpEx or operating expenses were fixed at the 3% above the previous year or whatever that mechanism was, but I remember it was fixed for until December of this last year, was that right?
Representing
the based on 2006 too, I think, the number. Is that
right,
correct?
It was the 2006 grossed up to be annualized because it started in April and then moved forward with the escalation factor that you identified. And so the response is correct for the most part. There's some operating expenditures associated with other fields that would be affected by the lease expenditure definition, but for the most part it's going to be the capital expenditure portion. And then the final portion, it was December 31, 2009 was the expiration of the
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Deduction. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
There's a lot of lists and a lot of questions, but I'm going to stay on. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seaton's point. On the standard deduction, did you learn additional information or additional perspective on the industry that allowed you to understand the tax structure and how it affected them?
Why don't you put yourself on the record, okay, and then we can both answer the
question. You've done this before.
My name is Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue, and Representative Guttenberg, through the chair. When ACES was passed, one of the first activities we had to undertake was the audit of the 2006 operating expenditures for both Prudhoe and Caparic, because we needed to establish that as quickly as possible as the baseline for what would be allowable lease expenditures from an operating expense point of view for those two fields. Because for the rest of 2006, then 2007, 2008, and 2009 would essentially be a indexed value off of that number. And so, yes, that was one of the first audits we dove into, so we were able to begin to understand better and learn how operating expenses were charged across the field, how they were grouped, where the data was. One of the first things we did was engage with the two operators and obtain what's called the joint account system, basically the charge system called the JADE system, I think, on the Prudhoe side. I'm not sure what it's called on the Caparic side. So we immediately kind of enmeshed with the operators to begin to digest and verify and validate the operating expenses. In that conversation, in that give and take, the operators in turn received immediate feedback from the department as to what was in and what was out of the bucket for lease expenditures, and that was served as guidance for them. Even though we didn't have a formal regulation yet, it served as the guidance of where the department was going.
If I can follow up. So from understanding what allowable expenses were under the standard deduction, did any of those years go beyond the index? Did the industry have an issue with operating costs going above what the standard deduction was, or did that main stay in the category? What was the, because they can spend more beyond the it's just not deductible.
Right. After the 06 was what it was. Whatever the level was the level that we accepted as the beginning of the index year. We have been advised, I checked with my auditors that, you know, and I can speak with reference to Prudhoe because it contains more than three taxpayers. I can speak with reference to Capart because it contains more than three taxpayers. In both of those instances, each taxpayer reports their view of what their operating expenses on a year-to-year basis. They do not necessarily match one another. They each have their own accounting systems and their own allocation systems. If we look at them as a group, on the whole, I would say that the reported operating expenditures exceeded by a small amount the standard deduction on the Caparic side. On the Pruda side, it was a little larger than what it was at Caparic, but in both instances, it was the actual expenditures exceeded what was the limitation imposed by the standard deduction for operating expenses for the following years.
Thank you. Any additional questions? I have, when we're talking a little bit in oil terms in Prudhoe Bay, we're talking in millions of dollars, not just hundreds of dollars. So when you say the difference in the standard deduction and what they would have had is a little difference, are we talking 100 million or 20 million or a million or $5?
Actually, it depends on the year. It might have been less than 100 million for some of the years and more than 100 million for other years. I don't have the actual numbers in front of me because it covers about 3 years in the.
That's not confidentiality or anything. We could have
that
information.
Well, and I would not be I would have to be reporting an averaged number because, again, as I say, each taxpayer, in some instance, someone reported less than the standard deduction, and in others, more. So I would have to average them.
But we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
Generally.
Okay. That's generally. I don't need to be specific, Pat, unless you have something else.
The only thing I want to clarify is that while the amount of additional lease expenditure that they experience is greater than the standard deduction in the 3 years, the impact on their tax liability was different in each year because primarily in 2008 their price was significantly higher, progressivity was higher, and so the impact of the standard deduction was significantly greater on their tax liability in 2008 than it was in 2009, even though the difference in the actual spending level was fairly similar. Right. So just want to make
because
sure.
Because that was a function of progressivity and pricing.
Yes.
But we're still talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. President Guttenberg.
And on the other side of that equation, the profits had escalated quite a bit also. So they're making more money. That's why they're paying more taxes.
Correct.
Okay.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
By the way, profit is not a bad word, and we won't go there in this committee. We will adjourn very quickly if we go down the bad profits. Thank you, Marcia. Proceed.
Okay. Chairman Johnson, I would like to walk through our comments on segments of the bill. And what I did is we tried to organize it in terms of as you go through the bill, which sections you tend to hit first. And so we're trying to stay sort of in that logical order. Up is forward.
To right.
Okay, there we go.
Before you start, can everyone see this? Is this good enough? We need to dim the lights, or is that sufficient for everyone? Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. The first section we examined was the resident worker tax rebate. And we looked at it, how would we administer this in terms of, how would we tackle it and what guidance could we give to this committee in terms of questions we would have and if there'd be some clarification that would help us administer this, this bill when passed into law. Our first concern was that the way the bill is written, it was unclear to us because the rebate will only affect a taxpayer and a taxpayer is only a producer. It was unclear to us that when we talked about labor or the workforce, was the intent of this committee to look at the workforce of the producer only, or the workforce of the producer and the contractors that they employ to engage in all of the various operations on the slope? And for us, that's a significant distinction, because in our review of the numbers, et cetera, the vast majority of the labor in the workforce is employed at the contractor level and not so much at the producer, their own discrete workforce. So some clarification on that would help us in terms of administering the language.
Before you get, there will be a CS.
Okay.
We will clarify that. Okay. Just so you know, it is the intention of the producer and the contractor.
Okay.
And we want to make sure that language is very clear, and we'll be happy to work with you and the Department of Labor on making sure that is clear as well. And I'm not going to answer your questions as
we go
through.
No, that's fine. I just
want to... But I do want to... I am making notes as to what I need to get with you to clarify the language.
Mr. Chairman, that was a concern of mine on page 29 of Mr. Dickinson's PowerPoint. He does note that it doesn't include, besides catering and security, engineering, transportation, communications, and construction.
Reverend Gunberg, there will be a CS. With boots on the ground.
Okay.
Thank you.
And again, I apologize if it sounds like I go from big to small, trying to work through the bill. Also in Section 2, which is what I'm referencing right now, there's a requirement that the individual that's charged with retaining the data about the labor workforce keep it for 3 years. Again, because in the tax world, whether this bill passes and changes the tax assessment period from 6 to 3 or not, what we look for is a continuity of records being retained for as long as the tax question remains open. So for us, a straight 3 year here might be modified, or until the close of the relevant tax year would be helpful to us. And I think if the bill is clarified to include contractors, it will help us when we look at Section 15, when it uses the phrase where the taxpayer incurs labor costs. We look at the definite, what does incur mean? And so as long as it's clear that it would include not only direct incursion of labor costs, but through a contractor, that facilitates our understanding of that provision. The second point I have on this slide is my tickler, is the rebate use and payment mechanism in terms of being unclear. Again, we're technocrats and bureaucrats, so we think about, again, how we're going to implement this. Because this bill couches the incentive in the form of a rebate and has it arise after the filing of the annual report that's due on March 31st, what actually happens in our tax world is a taxpayer is looking through the year and they're filing monthly payments, estimates of what they think their tax bill is going to be, such that when they arrive at the end of the year, each month they sort of true up as they learn more and more about what they think their tax bill is going to be. And we would look for some clarity from this committee that would advise us whether a taxpayer would be authorized to anticipate that they would ultimately receive a rebate and thus factor it into their monthly payments, or whether it's the intent of the committee that they would pay their tax bill without consideration of the rebate, such that when you arrive at the end of the tax year, the Department of Labor obtains the records and verifies for Department of Revenue whether the appropriate hiring rate has been met to qualify for a rebate. It would truly act as a rebate, much like we do with our credits,
right,
where someone applies, we look at it, and it given a value. By then we know what the tax bill is. We then could apply a rebate, which would be similar to a certificate. And then the next question we would have is, it might make sense if that is the mechanism, that the funding for those rebates, when we think about where's the money going to come from to pay those, would it need to be coming out of that credit fund that's set aside, that gets renewed through general funds?
Right.
It just questions about the mechanism that we could definitely benefit from more instruction from this committee. Another comment on Section 15, where it basically references a resident worker as being that which is defined in another section in the tax code. In that section, one of the last items of the definition of a resident worker is may be required to swear under oath that they are in fact, you know, in the state of domicile, et cetera. What would be helpful would be to know whether it's Department of Revenue or Department of Labor that would be administering that definition. In other words, someone needs to essentially create a form that would be given to the producers and their contractors if that becomes necessary, where we would have employees make that kind of affirmation of their residency. And so just an idea of which agency would have that authority.
Right. And we do have the Department of Labor to testify, and I'm meeting and working with them on that. Would that be something that you would want in the statute, or would that be something that could be handled through regulation?
We can handle it through regulation as long as there's something in this statute that gives one of us the authority to implement the definition in that section of the definition.
You sure?
Well, yeah.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe the Department of Labor is better, but maybe a better definition is, you know, having been a construction worker up north for many years, a lot of times a contract for a contractor is seasonal or short term, or 6 weeks, 2 weeks, 8 months. And I know we've talked about this before. If the definition of what's usable is what fits under the definition of it, they could use it as a tax credit. So, but the contractor comes in, let's say they're from outside with three people, you know, the owner, his brother-in-law, who's the construction manager, and the accountant, and they hire 10 Alaskans, or let's say they hire 20 Alaskans to actually do the work, and they've got, you know, 80-90% Alaskan hire, and then the contract is over and they go back to Arkansas and for the rest of the year. What is it, only the percentage of time that they were in Alaska that they were actually doing the job, or does it count the percentage of time that they were finishing up the paperwork at home? Or I mean, how is that, would you expect that to be fine, to actually be able to look at what's creditable?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I would certainly defer to Department of Labor to do a better job of, because I think they are in, that is part of their jurisdiction, is to decide who's resident, who's not a resident. All I can do as an administrator on the revenue side is look at that statutory definition, and it seems like a solid definition in that it, you know, says that you've either applied for a hunting permit, permanent fund. It truly does reach to who is truly an Alaskan year-round, is what that definition reads to me. It isn't like someone could pop into the state, be here for 6 months, claim, well, my heart right now wants to be an Alaskan, but then 6 months later they change their mind. I think that definition requires a little more demonstration of this truly being your state of domicile. So I based on the definition, I would say that what you just described probably would not qualify as a resident Alaska worker, someone who was here seasonally.
Okay. My point, but okay, I'll ask Department of Labor, that's fine.
Good. Thank
you. Oh, we didn't raise something. No. Okay. One of our other concerns is the legal authority to adjust the tax post-audit for the Department of Revenue, and I think it's just something that we need to make sure and see that the bill addresses, because right now we have the right to review the information that Department of Labor acquires from their audits, but there's actually missing the authority for Department of Revenue to adjust the tax bill based on a finding that the rebate was qualified or disqualified on subsequent review. So it's a technical requirement, but in our statute, I think it's section M of this section, we just need to add in that we have language that allows us to go back and adjust the tax bill if we find on audit that a credit was inappropriately granted. So we just need to make sure and expand that to ensure that we can adjust a tax bill if we find that a rebate was inappropriately granted as well.
How do you handle the film industry rebate, the 10% local hire there?
To be honest, I don't think we've done a single audit of those. The regs are out, but right. I don't think we've done the audit on there. But I believe the authority resides there in the corporate income tax to adjust on audit, that that includes the ability to adjust the corporate income tax. But we can look at that language, Chairman Johnson, and just see how they've addressed it and ensure that we can make that recommendation.
We do have some precedent, and if we haven't ever done it, that's...
Right.
We will be coming soon, by the way.
Right. Okay,
good. Go ahead.
And again, I think as long as we add the contractor, we should be okay. Oh, and also, in terms of the legal authority to reach into the data, the Department of Labor's section that talks about their right to go in and extract or require data to be made available to them so they can verify and audit the certifications of residency, the way it's written, it only covers agents or employees of such person. And a contractor might not fit that criteria. So again, part and parcel of correcting this to cover contractors is to ensure that Department of Labor has the right to review the contractor's data. Because in all likelihood, a producer will simply ask a contractor to provide them a document that verifies their compliance, but the underlying data will reside with the contractor. So we need to make sure Department of Labor can look at that underlying data and do their spot checks. I would next like to just refer quickly. We did a numerical analysis, so just trying to understand how the rebate would work, and this is the bill's structure in terms of percentage resident higher in the rebate amount. And this rebate is essentially the percent of the total tax bill that would be reduced if these hiring criteria were met.
And I want to clarify that that's not including the progressivity or the royalty taxes or any of that. This is strictly the base rate.
Oh, okay. We did not pick that up from our reading of the bill, so okay. We missed that.
Yeah, it's not the progressivity. It is just that 20% base rate and royalty. So I want to make sure that that's
the 25%.
25 to 20. Okay. We're looking for 100% local hiring.
Well, if that's the case, we'll have to probably rerun our numbers.
Right. And if it's not clear in the bill, we want to make sure that it is.
Okay. Okay. So that helps to know. Base 25% only.
Because I turn to your next page, I'm not...
Tickled. Yeah, no, and so what we did is we thought it applied to all of the tax bill. And so when we did this, we will rerun this.
Yeah, but so let's ignore that page.
Yeah, let's skip this for now. And what we were striving to do just analytically was take three different companies of three different sizes with roughly three different tax bills and try to discern if they were moving, trying to aspire to hire more Alaskans to get to the next increment or bracket. What number of employees would it be, and what would the cost be to the state of going from to in exchange for a certain $1 million of rebate? What would we get? What would it cost us per employee? So we'll come back to this, Chairman Johnson, whenever we're there. The only thing I will say is that one of the things we learned in doing this exercise is there's two ways to approach this. We did this with an assumption that an employer would simply keep their status quo and seek to hire Alaskans to raise their percentage. There is the possibility that an employer could actually simply fire non-Alaskans without hiring any new Alaskans, thereby altering their overall percent of Alaska hire. So, you know, we didn't try to model that right now, but we just want to flag that there is that potential for in the tax world. We see every manner of effort at minimizing tax bills, so we put on that.
No. and I appreciate that, but I'm still going to operate on the assumption that these are for-profit companies.
Yeah.
And that they're going to want to have employees to generate revenue, to generate profits. So I can't think they're just going to go fire all the non-Alaskans and now they're 100%. And I can't see where that's going to make any sense.
No.
But it might. I don't.
Chairman Johnson, it might not make sense for big moves, but if you're on the bubble, you know, if you can fire one or two people and suddenly fall into a bracket that gets you $10 million or $20 million, you're a for-profit company, and that might make sense.
Yeah. And when they hire those people back, they will be Alaskans. Did I see a hand? Did Representative Tuck, did I see a hand go up?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to point out that yesterday we discussed how, you know, accountants oftentimes are the ones that make these types of decisions. Sometimes not always best for production, but they're looking at how they can save. And I'm glad that important fact was brought up because we were talking about the legality of not despairing against residents versus non-residents, and this may end up being a case that non-residents can fight to show disparity. So I would hate to see something like that actually take place.
Representative Tuck, if that happened, that would be recourse, I believe, against the company, not the state. And really, I don't care. If somebody wants to sue the company, that's not my issue. My issue is putting Alaskans to work.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, I think the one thing that we picked up when we were doing the analysis is the fact that simply through the structure of having it be tiers based upon a percent, you end up with behavioral issues that are unique to each taxpayer that creates inefficient behavior, basically. That and that's what we want to make sure that the committee is well aware of, is that because you have these breaks, that literally the difference of one or two employees being added could mean tens of millions of dollars of additional rebate. You have this, and because the methodology is just hours worked, you have situations where a company, a for-profit company, is incentivized to bring in three or four people to just stand around and get minimum wage and build a bunch of hours, and they get an extra $10 million for it. And that is just something we want to bring to your attention and recognize as an outcome of this structure.
And the converse of that is the reason the small increments was, once you got from 80 to 85, you don't want them to say, gosh, it's such a big jump to get to the next hurdle that I can stop hiring Alaskans. Right. So somewhere in there has to be a balance. And so I'd be happy to work with you on that and the problems and that. But I'd certainly like to not take away the incentive to hire more once you got to the number that you thought was right. Mm-hmm. I want to get that 100% number,
right,
or 95, or the higher number, and I want to incentivize people with steps to do that. So that's the goal.
And Mr. Chair, I guess just from a structural standpoint, it may make more sense to have just a straight line as opposed to tiers, where you can come up with a mechanism where for each additional Alaskan, they'd get an incremental change in their tax. And so I'm just pointing that out from a structural standpoint. We'd be happy to work with you.
And I also, we thought about that, but also that's going to be a bill that's going to be very difficult to write according to our drafters. So we wanted to, you know, it could be 100 pages.
Just doing that,
but I'm happy to look at it. And as long as the goal is met, I really don't have a dog in the fight as to how.
Okay.
Chairman Johnson, the other thing we wanted to make sure and share with this committee was our understanding, because the fundamental definition of what labor costs qualify are lease expenditures, and we've just completed our regulation process defining what are lease expenditures, so we at least wanted to share with this committee what we understood to be the labor costs that would fall within this category of lease expenditures. And I do have on the line our audit master, John Larson, who was the key individual working this particular issue. So, John, I'm going to ask to you to walk us through, okay?
Thank you, Marcia. You want me to just walk you through the slides there?
Yes, please.
Identify yourself first, Mr. Larson, please, for the record.
Yes, sir. I am John Larson. I'm an audit master with the Department of Revenue.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Larson.
And as you see on your first slide there, basically what we have are two classes of allowable employee expenses for the operator. And the first tier are employees that are located on the site of the oil, gas, exploration, development, or production operations. And that also includes the infrastructure for those operations. The other tier would be the operator's employees having special and specific engineering, geological, or other technical skills, and these employees do not necessarily have to be located on site, but the cost of their labor are limited to handling specific and problems or operating conditions involving the operations there, and only as to the time actually incurred working on those problems. And then the other, I guess, kind of outside the operator's labor would be the contractor labor, which is 100% deductible.
Hang on just a second. Representative Seaton.
So
I'm trying to recall, under the second group of employees, those employees wouldn't necessarily be in Alaska. They could be outside, they could be in England or anywhere.
That's right. And I guess the essential criteria is that historically, prior to electronic telecommunications, satellites, things like that, it was really a clear-cut, pretty simple distinction that if you were on a lease or property, that you were chargeable. But with the implementation of the new technologies, it's in essence, I guess you could say, expanded the lease boundary. And so what we're trying to do there is realize that there are people that are employed directly in the operations but may not necessarily be directly on the lease site itself. And I think that there's a kind of a benefit for both the operator and the state to recognize that there is a cost savings and that they don't necessarily have to be on site with the travel, the housing, the safety, and all those other things going on there. And so for these classes of people, like I say, technical labor, there are times where they can perform lease operations without having to be on site of the lease.
Representative Seaton, follow-up?
And I'm trying to figure out if we're supportive of those operations. Can that be accountants, et cetera, if they're working on maintaining records for leases in Alaska?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's correct. And as we walk through this presentation here, I'll try and give some examples of what would be an allowable type labor and what's not an allowable.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And before you go on, Representative Wilson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the contract labor that is 100% deductible. Do you have a handle kind of what is normal? I mean, because they could contract out every single thing that there is practically. So that's a lot.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I suppose that's an option, but I think it goes back to the assumption that these are for-profit companies and that they are also working in conjunction with their joint operating partners. And the presumption is that they're not going to make a decision that's contrary to their best financial interest there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, the idea is that the contract labor is going to be for services that the company needs. I mean, they're mm-hmm. paying somebody to do something for them. They're paying somebody else. And that is presumed to take the place of them hiring somebody themselves and having them do the same service. And so for us, it's really either or. We're going to pay the same amount. We might, hopefully they're finding a more efficient contractor than what it would cost for them to do it, to pay this person themselves. And so we benefit from their motivation to bring in contractors where it's more efficient to do so. And we will give them 100% of that cost, recognizing that it's either that or they hire somebody to do that service, and we're going to pay 100% of that as well. Because we're paying 100% of tier one or class one, class two.
It's not excluded.
And we're just saying that contract labor substitutes for one of these two, so we're going to give you all of that as well.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But there's also nothing that says that contract labor at this point are Alaskans.
That's correct.
Okay. So we're paying for them.
Yeah, that's correct.
This is
going to encourage. Right. Private discussion going on. Not that private. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about the scenario of a Alaskan that we have a module that's being built, let's say, in Washington State, and we have an Alaskan that's overseeing the project down there, and he flies down to Washington. Would that employee, under what we have written now, be able to be able to have that deduction based on that employee?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, based on our understanding of that resident, Alaska resident definition, as long as the individual did not undertake Washington as their new state of domicile, as long as Alaska remains their state of domicile and it's a temporary dislocation to, on a project basis, we would assume that individual would still meet the criteria of the Alaska resident definition.
Follow-up, were you done? Representative Gutenberg?
Thank you. On this, so what you're saying, the way you read this, the construction of modules outside would be included in this definition?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, actually, we would just be looking at each individual laborer. And in the instance of Representative Tuck's question, he was focused on the project manager, who was an Alaskan, who had flown down to Washington to oversee that particular project construction.
Question is, under our definition of lease expenditures, is the construction of a module a deductible lease expenditure?
A construction of a module. John, do you want to? I won't jump in. I'll let you do that one. But yes, I mean, construction of a module in Washington State that's going to be sea lifted up, John, would that be a lease expenditure?
Yes, Marcia, I believe that's true. That would be a lease expenditure. As long as it's placed in service. If it's not placed in service, then I don't think that would count as a lease expenditure.
So they could build it, move it up, and not use it?
Yeah.
Which, remember, we are talking for-profit companies. Marcia, go ahead.
Okay, John, I've moved on to the list of Type 1 allowable labor.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to the Type 1, I just wanted to list some examples just so you could see. But as I said, basically in the introduction there, that any employee that's on the site of the oil, gas, exploration, development, or production operations is going to be chargeable, including the drillers, roughnecks, roustabouts, electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters, welders, mechanics, anybody else that you can think of on site, you name it. And these examples here pertain to the exploration, development, or production operations themselves. And if we move to the next slide, you'll see employees working in the infrastructure or support operations. And these would include people in the camps, housekeeping, janitorial, food service, your operation centers, all your technicians within the centers there, staging pads, roads, bridges, landing areas, and similar transportation structures. Therefore, all your employees operating the graders, doing the road maintenance, bridge building, all those types of activities would be included. Employees working on communication systems, because as I mentioned earlier, it's this ability to communicate remotely that has essentially expanded the lease boundary. And so we do allow for employees working on the communication systems out in the field as a support area. We're not allowing employees that are working on the communications that go back to their main office in Houston or LA or wherever it might be. Continuing examples of support operations would be medical facilities, emergency personnel, security and repair and maintenance shops. Moving on from there.
I should
go ahead and pause and ask if there's any questions on those particular slides there.
Yeah, just a second. Did I hear you say that someone who flew up and worked on a communications, that was not an allowable deduction?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure who the question there, but through the chair.
That would be
the
chair.
Can you repeat that question again?
If someone flies up and they repair a communications or anything, and they fly back, that is not an allowable deduction?
No, if that's what I said, I'm sorry. If someone flew up to work on a on-site there on a telecommunication system, that would be an allowable charge.
Okay, thank you. I misunderstood then. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions while we're at a breaking point? Go ahead.
Okay. Continuing on then with employees that are the more technical nature, that have special and specific engineering, geological, or other technical skills, that would be chargeable whether they are on site of the operation or not, and only as to that portion of time that they actually devote to the exploration, development, or production operations would be engineers, whether it's a reservoir engineer, petroleum engineer, anyone engaged in those operations, geologists, environmental specialist, because we recognize that they may have to do some permitting or perhaps archaeological work in order to be in compliance with their permit, so we've allowed costs for those types of activities. Employees engaged in field automation systems, and these are the type where you can actually remotely operate the field from a distant location. And then also employees engaged in computer applications that are specific to the oil or gas exploration, development, or production operations.
Hang on just a second. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to recall or figure out from revenue who determines what labor they want to call or classify or apply for as a employee who is a lease expenditure. In other words, we don't go up and audit and say, okay, every person that's employed in either this tier one or tier two is going to count as an employee for a lease expenditure. And so could a company, could the accountants say, we're not going to include these geologists as lease expenditures and these certain engineers or environmental specialists or whatever, because we will save 2% on our entire taxable revenue by changing and not qualifying those people as lease expenditures?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, as far as the lease expenditure regulations go, there, I guess you could say ambivalent to who the person is and where they live. That's not really whether a person is a resident or not has no bearing on whether it's a lease expenditure or not. I would say it's more dependent on the job duty that's being performed, and the question of whether they're a resident or not is something that's outside the scope of the lease expenditure, and that, I'd say that's a separate issue with the other bills that are pending before the committee there.
Commissioner Galvin, you have an enlightenment?
Yeah, just want to note that deducting a particular employee because they would qualify as a lease expenditure is not mandatory. And so under the scenario that you raised, if there are employees who are outside of Alaska who would, under the definition of lease expenditures, actually qualify as a lease expenditure, but if this bill were to pass in a similar form and that adding them to the calculation would result in the company not hitting a particular threshold and enjoying a particular rebate, then they could choose not to claim them as a lease expenditure.
But and I appreciate that, but the local hire has nothing to do with lease expenditure. If they work an hour, they're counted in the total.
Mr. Chair, it does have to do with lease expenditure, because what it says is that it is the total labor that falls as a lease expenditure. That's the way it's defined. And so that's why we're going through this exercise, is just to show you what is in the universe of lease expenditures. Because that, and Mr. Chair, let me just, I guess, caution, if we break that and we say that it is all labor costs under some other definition of connected to Alaska, then we've got a whole different problem, because we're going to have to come up with a different definition of what is connected to Alaska in order to define that whole, that the denominator of our percentage calculation. And so we do recognize the need for defining the whole of the labor cost around lease expenditures. That works, but we wanted to make sure the committee understood where the edges are for that. Within that, regardless of how we were to define it, we would always face some aspect of voluntary reporting from the company, because they're going to provide us with their picture of what falls within the whole. and then we would go in with Department of Labor to confirm whether or not we agree that, that all the parts that are in there are properly there. Whether there's something that they never report, we'll never know. I mean, that's just realistically not going to be within our understanding. So just getting to the question, that's a possibility, but that's, I mean, it again goes to that question of what is the behavioral reaction to this, and we just need to make sure we tighten that down.
Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm a fisherman, so I was skilled, and my job was to try and get around regulation. And so
I'm glad you're on this committee, because we're going to tighten this up where we really can. How's that?
Right. And on page six, where we're talking about is by resident workers, the cost of which is included in allowable lease expenditure. Now, our normal consideration is, you know, hey, you're going to get credited for that and get to deduct that expenditure off your taxes of his wages. If you classify that person as a part of the allowable lease expenditures. If you don't put them in as a lease expenditure, then they're not a lease expenditure and they're not counted against you. I don't know how we get to that point. That'll be up to you to figure out. But that's the concern that I have, is if we can just not declare any non-Alaskan and save 5% on our gross taxes by having 100% workforce, because 15% we didn't declare and we just went ahead and paid them out of pocket, we could have a, you know, a huge non-intended reaction there.
Certainly a possibility.
Chairman Johnson?
Yes.
One solution may lay, now that we fully understand how the credit works against the base tax, we'll run some numbers and figure out, as long as this credit doesn't dominate the value to an operator of having that underlying lease expenditure, then the drive to get the lease expenditure should still dominate, and this tax credit will hopefully be subordinated to that. And that's what we need to run the numbers and see, verify that.
And I'm hoping the math works out that it's better for them to do it hire the Alaskan than cheat.
I
and
agree.
Cheat's a strong word, but I would appreciate the running of those numbers.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, we'd like to refer to it as tax avoidance.
Tax avoidance.
As opposed to tax evasion. And they're perfectly they have their right to avoid taxes. We do
And I think that's a practice that we all try to do around April 15th.
John,
before we go on, Representative Wilson had a question.
Well, I'm thinking if because of unemployment insurance and all the other things involved, I wouldn't want to work. I mean, I wouldn't want to get paid under the table, because if something happened to me, then I wouldn't get unemployment. Yeah. Or how does that work?
I don't think we're talking about under the table as much as we're off records of, as it relates to the tax structure of Alaska. I don't think we're talking about avoiding any unemployment taxes or federal laws or any of that. We're talking about under our table, not the federal table.
Okay.
The avoidance part, right? Whatever the table.
Okay, John, we're on the overhead.
Okay.
Before we do that, I tell you what we're going to do here. We're going to go until about 4 o'clock, but we're going to take a break, and we're going to start precisely at 3 resources time. So we're going to take approximately a 6-minute break. We're going to go off record at 3 o'clock. We will gavel back in, so we're going to recess to the call of the chair, which the chair is calling 3 o'clock.
So we're breaking
right now.
Right now.
Yeah, it's just a time. I figured it's a time for everybody to take a break. We'll come back in. We'll be here at least an hour. So we got 7 minutes. Thank you. Let's go ahead and get started again. We have established a quorum, and we will continue to take testimony. I'm assuming, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, that you will remember where you were.
We do.
Thank you.
Okay, John, I think we were just starting the overhead discussion.
Okay. One of the changes that was made with ACES is that the legislature recognized in a statute that there was a distinction between direct cost and overhead. And this is not a minor distinction out there in the oil field. prior to ACES, the overhead had been included as a direct cost, and after passage of that, it was changed to just being a lease expenditure and separate from the direct cost. And so the previous portion of the presentation that we went through with the type 1 and 2 type labor there referred basically to the direct charges that operators will make pursuant to their operations there. And so the purpose of the overhead is to allow an operator to recover costs that they incur as operator of the property that are not recovered through the direct charges. And the mechanism that they use to do that is the overhead mechanism. And these would be for administration, and I'll get to some of those types of costs later. But basically, one of the, I guess, tenets, you might say, of overhead in a joint operating agreement is that an operator shall neither profit nor incur cost due to its position as the operator. And so all the working interest owners and parties to the agreement have resolved to make the operator whole for these types of costs. And so that's what I'm saying here. I'm sure everybody can read the slide, that the operator recovers certain indirect and overhead costs incurred off-site of the exploration, development, or production operations, and that's because if it was an on-site cost, they would recover it as a direct cost. The overhead costs are not directly billed but recovered through the overhead allowance.
Hang on a sec. Representative Seaton has a question.
So these jobs, which include people as well, are covered in the overhead allowance, and so the overhead, so they're not individually reported to as a lease expense because it's covered in the overhead?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that is correct. Their costs are not billed direct, but they're recovered through the overhead mechanism.
And Representative Seaton, through the chair, this is Marcia Davis. The reason we included it is because we want to make it very clear that overhead does contain labor costs. It is allowed as a lease expenditure, and therefore, under our reading of this bill, we want to make it clear that we would read the bill to include the labor costs incurred by an operator that are embedded in their overhead charge, even though it's an indirect charge and doesn't look as dominant or as obvious as the direct charges for labor where they're working on, you know, the property, et cetera. So when we look at the next slide, which are technical supervisors, drafting, engineering aides, accounting, clerical, certain legal, not the attorneys, off-site computer communications activities, these are things that support the operator to do their job, and they're allowed to charge the cost for it. And so we just pose this, that currently as written, this bill would cover all of those labor costs. And if that's not the intent of the committee, then we just wanted to flag that this class of lease expenditure, which does include a labor cost, is currently included in the total bucket of lease expenditure labor costs that we would be examining and creating a percentage out of.
And we can do this later, yeah. But I want to look at the advantage or disadvantages of including this. I want to include as many people in the formula that pushes Alaskan jobs as I can. Mm-hmm. There may be some point where we have to cut that off because it doesn't make sense, mm-hmm. because these people are probably good fishermen too.
Yes.
It doesn't want to come.
Well, and John, typically on the overhead labor, are we generally looking at the people that are employed and working out of the headquarters office? So if a producer, if an operator, for instance, overhead is only going to be charged by an operator. So if the operator is located in Alaska, then you would dominantly be talking about the people that are located in, say, for instance, BP's building in Anchorage, or in ConocoPhillips' building in Anchorage, or the Chevron office, maybe wherever, you know, whether it's in Anchorage or Kenai or something. So I think because it's overhead is by an operator, John, would you agree that the majority of these employees doing these services are already located in Alaska?
Marcia, and through the chair, I think you have to be really careful when you're talking about overhead, because one of the issues with overhead is that you know, except maybe in particular situations, you're not talking about specific jobs or functions. It's a kind of a general allowance that's meant to cover a category of costs that are incurred by the operator. But as far as specifically identifying those individuals, I think that that's an area where I kind of want to tread pretty lightly.
Okay. Thank you, John.
Representative Gunberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, in the discussion of ACES, we were talking about deductions for overhead. We were talking about an accountant's time outside. You know, the headquarters, an accountant sits there, and a third of his time is based upon doing the calculations for North Slope work or someplace else. Is that what we're talking about? You're asking the question whether we include that the same way in this bill, whether we included that over there.
Representative Gutenberg, yes, that is the question.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question I'm trying to envision here is the differential between operator and non-operator, and whether with the workforce makeup, whether this is by taxpayer, I presume. Mm-hmm. So if let's say we had a large taxpayer that wasn't an operator of any fields, because that's what brought this up, is this is an operator expense. So if they're not an operator in the field, they may be a large taxpayer, have few employees, and have high percentages. Am I correct, or do we, under this bill, look at fields and divvy up all the employees of a field based on the percentage of ownership of that field?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, what we would do is look at each taxpayer's costs that they report in their tax return, and they get allocated a share of the lease expenditure for each field in which they own an ownership interest. So if someone owns 20% of Prudhoe, they will be charged 20% of those lease expenditure costs that they pay. They then reflect that in their tax return, offset those against their revenue to arrive at what their tax value is and calculate their tax. So we would consider them just as the operator, an employer of those people. It would be their share of the labor costs. So every working interest owner on the North Slope would be considered to have a share of these labor costs and therefore have a share of the rebate. So they're driven by the operator. The operator controls who gets hired and who's doing what, by and large. And the other owners get the ripple effect. They basically get the result of choices made by the operator.
Mr. Chair.
You've been demoted too, Commissioner. Mr. Galvin.
All of this, what this revolves around, just to pinpoint it, is incur. The word in the draft bill is the taxpayer, if they incur labor costs. So what we are interpreting that to mean is if they are charged by somebody, whether it's the operator of the field in which they're a working interest owner or a contractor that they hire directly, they're charged for labor costs, then we consider them to have incurred those costs, which means, according to what Marcia just described, if you think of one field, the operator is going to incur initially 100% of the cost. They're going to have a certain percentage of Alaskans who are going to be hired. They're going to divvy that cost up among the working interest owners, among the percentage of ownership, which means that those working interest owners are going to then ultimately incur their portion of that labor cost with that percentage of Alaska hire. Which means that, you know, for just from a broad scale, if you are an operator of one field and a working interest owner of another field, then you have more direct control over the percentage that you're going to be allocated out of the field you're operating, and you're going to be more sort of a rider in the car of the other operator who will make decisions about Alaska Hire that will then be passed along to you, and it's the blend of the two that will ultimately determine your qualification for this rebate.
Representative Seaton.
And so is your interpretation of this then that, let's say you have 20%, I have 20% of Representative Olson because I'm a 20% owner of a field.
Mm-hmm.
So is he a Alaskan person, or is he 20% of the hours worked? How do we distinguish the, under your reading of the bill, whether where we start from costs to the number of laborers to people?
The unit of measurement under the bill is hours. And so you will be a working interest owner of a field that includes Representative Olson's services, and that will be X number of hours for the whole field, okay, for the year. Of that, there'll be 80%, hopefully, or more, that will be Alaska worker hours. And then you will get 20% of those hours, both the total hours worked and the total Alaska hours. Now, if that field dominates your Alaska portfolio, then it may not matter too much what your other stuff is, because you will get that 80% as a significant portion of your overall calculation. But, for example, if you have another field, let's say that the field you're working interest on is right at 80, and you're an operator of another field that has 70%, then you will knock yourself out of qualification for that first tier, because the blend of the two will, by definition, bring you down below 80. But your working interest partner of that field, who has no other operations anywhere else in the state, will get the rebate. So again, it's taxpayer specific. It will depend upon your portfolio and the number of hours that are being worked for the various fields and your share of those hours.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And so I'm just trying to figure out how this works. So if we have salaried employees, you've got some formula that you say a salaried employer is going to be so many hours, and that's the way we do it. I mean, it's in here. It says regardless of hourly or other basis, but I'm not sure how. Does this give you enough to make a calculation that will stand up?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I would defer that question to Department of Labor. My guess is they probably could use a little more guidance, either assumption of a full-time schedule. The problem with people who are salaried is they may, in actuality, work 20 hours of a day rather than their, you know, alleged 8 hours a day. And so there
like
could...
Like most of us.
Yeah,
most of us. Alleged.
Certainly during session. And so... guidance from the legislature would be helpful on what to do in that instance.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was asking that question.
And I appreciate that. I'm making notes. And Representative Vindberg, there will be a CS. go ahead.
John, let's jump ahead to what's not deductible.
Sure, yeah. I think you covered page 15 there pretty well for us. So moving on to what's not allowable lease expenditure. And you'll notice that a couple of these terms end up on both pages, and I think that might be one of the reasons that I was kind of remiss to identify specific jobs or people associated with the overhead. And specifically there, I'm talking about the legal and accounting people. But moving to the top of the list, tax expense would not be an allowable lease expenditure. And labor expenses that are solely for the benefit of an individual lessee and not necessarily for the benefit of the joint operations or productions are not a lease expenditure, and neither are community, public, and government relations. And so let me just kind of back up just for a brief second and talk about the legal and accounting, because no, I'd say there's no two joint operating agreements are alike. And so when you look at them, there's a lot of joint operating agreements out there that will have an election. And in that election, there's certain classes of cost that you would say, are you going to include this as a direct expense, or are you going to include this in your overhead rate? And depending on which election you make, then your overhead rate will be adjusted accordingly. And examples of those types of costs might be certain types of the technical labor, perhaps the computer and the lease operations applications for remote technologies. Whether you charge that director in the overhead rate can oftentimes be an election. For the legal personnel, some joint operating agreements will allow legal costs for perfecting the lease or protecting your interest in the lease. But generally, legal costs are not allowed. Accounting, there is some necessary accounting that's done to pay all your people up there. So certainly those costs are covered as a part of the overhead rate, but the rest of the day-to-day operations of the accounting function for all of the rest of the operators or producers, employees would not be covered by the rate there. As far as the labor expenses that are for the benefit of the joint operations, and I think that this goes to a question that Representative Seaton asked earlier, is that the lease expenditures are allowed for the operator who, the person that actually runs the lease. And then you have your other working interest owners who are the producers that also have an interest in that lease, but not in the day-to-day operations. And so who is actually employed on the lease and does the work there is the determination of the operator. And then the working interest owners pay their representative share of the operator's cost there for those employees. But as far as, their individual geologists or engineers that are looking out specifically for the interest of the company, those types of employees are not chargeable as a lease expenditure. I guess one way to look at it is, rather than being involved into the day-to-day operations and the production operations, because we are talking about a production tax, those employees are not included as a lease expenditure.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to figure out, if you have a leasee or a producer who is the sole owner of a field or a lease, you're not excluding them from having these expenditures, are you?
No, if you're the sole owner, Representative Guttenberg through the chair, if you are the sole owner of the lease, you are the operator of the lease, and you would qualify for those expenditures.
Okay, but you have a set of criteria which are things outside of that would apply in the same instance.
Representative Guttenberg through the chair, no, the lease expenditures regulations that we've developed apply to whether you're an operator with other parties as working interest owners or whether you're an operator as the sole party of interest in the field.
Okay. I think you answered close enough.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I was hearing something a little discordant with what I thought. And so if you have an operator, do the working interest owners, or whatever we're calling them, people that own a share of that lease, do they pay the operator a portion of the costs, or do they actually receive lease expenditures to take off of their taxes? I mean, you have an operator that's operating, you have partners in there, there's a joint deal, and they pay the costs, their proportion amount of the costs to the operator. Is that the way it works, or is the way it works that the operator is operating and then he apportions out the lease costs to and actually transfers them to the other owners? Because I think that we've got a real difference here.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the almost in all cases, an operator will be on the, they will represent all the other owners in the relationship to contractors and others. So they will incur the legal obligation and be responsible for paying the entire bill. They then turn and shift out the cost to the other parties to be reimbursed. So they bill them and they get reimbursed. You know, there may be a very rare instance where you have a very small operator and, you know, they kind of can't take the hit, so they allocate the bill, but that's very unusual.
Representative State
Chairman, so the lease expenditures then don't flow to the minority owners. They're just paying a share of costs, and the lease expenditures are actually maintained with the operator?
No, once paid by a working interest owner, when they pay their share of their billed cost from the operator, they incur that cost for purposes of taxes. That becomes their legal lease expenditure that they can report against their tax return.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions while we're here? Commissioner? Oh, wait a minute, hang on. Representative Olson.
Just for discussion purposes only, when we do the CS, or when the chair does the CS, would it be easier if we took the original version of ACES and put the local hire provision into it? Because that's what it looks like.
It's pretty close.
For discussion purposes, Representative Olson, no, because then we'd have two different universes of, lack of a better term, lease expenditure. And both the taxpayer and the state would have to have simultaneously two different definitions, and that would create a burden for both of us. That would be pretty significant.
Follow-up? But we didn't quite present the same level of progressivity as we had in the original version of ACES, as I recall.
I'm sorry, say that?
We had 20% originally in the first version of ACES. 20%
base tax?
Yeah, instead of 25.
No, it was 25% in the original ACES.
I think the base tax was 25.
I thought it was 20, I apologize. No. But the progressivity was
0.2.
Roughly,
and there was a gross tax floor.
Yeah.
All taxes are gross.
Sorry.
So it sounded like he's just endorsed his bill.
That would have been, back further.
Right.
Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to ask a question here, and that is, you know, if our goal here is to incentivize people to hire Alaskans, wouldn't it be just a lot cleaner to say the state of Alaska is going to give a rebate of $20,000 to every employee above 50% that's hired into the company? And then we would have a known amount, it would be significant amount, we would say whatever, or 80% if you want, as you have in your bill, but we would have a significant incentive for actual hiring of Alaskans without having to go through a really complex and calculation and regulatory setting procedure.
Representative Seaton, I think that would be, in a perfect world, that'd be the way to go, but I don't think that would withstand. That doesn't make it optional. That makes an Alaskan on a different par as an out-of-state. This makes it optional. No one has to hire. And this is a credit against for hiring. This is a credit. So I think you'd have a little different standard. I don't think that would stand up the muster as much as of giving the credit. It might. Yeah. And I'd be happy to look at it.
Okay.
But I think that we're looking at, if you just do it across the board, you might be setting up a standard that Alaskan is on a different plane than a non-Alaskan. I understand where you're going. We'll take a look at it.
If we're looking at a credit that they can apply for if they want, it just seems like, rather than a very complex regulatory thing, we might be able to get it.
Thank you. And once again, in Representative Seaton, this was modeled a little bit after the film credit that we've already voted on. So it's kind of trying to take something that withstood at least a little bit of time. I don't think it's ever withstood a legal challenge, but at least withstood some time. So that's kind of where we're going with this.
Okay.
Ms. Davis?
Yes. Chairman Johnson, looking at the progressivity rate change, I think folks recognize the charts, and this just simply captures what ACE's nominal tax rate looks like. So it captures the base tax with the kickoff and where it drops, where it goes up to the from the 0.4 to the 0.1 slope. This one captures the change, which would be, again, similar kickoff, but it goes longer out to 155, that it maintains the 0.2 slope. Yeah. And this simply overlays the two charts, so you can see the delta being the space between the two lines. What we did is, what was more relevant to us was just looking at the change in state revenue and where that, if the state didn't have the revenue, who did? And so what this shows is, and we did this across three oil amounts, oil prices, and the key point here is one that when the state gives up revenue, it isn't a purely efficient transfer to the contractors. The feds capture a chunk, and this is rounded to the nearest $100 million, so big dollars. So that's, you know, you'll see big swings, but roughly you'll see once you get to 76 and you're starting to deal with the progressivity, you're seeing money shift to the federal government. And if you're out in a $100 barrel world, you're looking at a sizable amount still shifting over to the feds. So, you know, somewhere in the range, once progressivity starts to play a bigger role, that's where you'll start to see more money shifting to the federal government. So the only point here is it's a contrast of the efficiency of this money transfer versus, you know, something that's, and perhaps even the direct money transfer that Representative Seaton was describing might also have some leakage to the federal tax as well. The interest rate changes, what we looked at, we were familiar with working with the interest rate change because that was a big deal to our department. We are very concerned about the fact that retroactive application of the regulations, we can waive the penalty associated with an amended or revised tax bill that's caused by a change or by retroactive application of regulation, but we don't have the statutory authority to waive the interest that would accrue. And so when we were asked by the governor what would we see as an important improvement to ACES, we certainly lined up and said, let's make sure that the interest doesn't run until a reasonable period after the regulation gets in place. So there's a slight difference in our approach to this bill's approach. This bill used a 30-day after the effective date. We used the first day of the second month following, so it could be as low as 31 days, but as high as 60 days. And again, it's just simply making sure that we and the taxpayer have enough time to react to get in an amended bill. So it's not a huge difference. And we also, like this bill, did the over and under payment. So we've also done it on the overpayment. Please disregard that little footnote. There was a typo. It says that your committee substitute does change it, but it does not change the rule. So we're the same there too. The place that that this bill adds a unique factor, and that is in the change to the interest rate itself. We did look at that as a department and talked to a lot of the folks in the Attorney General's office and others who were around when this bill was changed the first time when the interest rate was raised. What we learned is it was raised previously in part because interest rates were much higher at that time, but secondly, there was a view that taxpayers were essentially using the state as the bank, so to speak, and so there needed to be a high enough interest rate that taxpayers would be incentivized to go ahead and pay disputed amounts, et cetera, and not because when you look at the difference, the state might earn 5% on it, but a company might be able to make 10 or 15% on the money that they keep in their pocket. And from a revenue forecast and flow point of view for the legislature to know what monies are coming into general funds, you know, it was easier to just not make the state the bank. And that's why we didn't change the interest rate on this provision. So, but those are the policy.
Yeah, and this was modeled after what the IRS does, basically.
Right.
So,
right.
And I don't like to model the IRS very often, but thank you.
Okay. We have the well-related credit, and the one piece here that we wanted to talk about was we also struggled with the same thing that the bill sponsor here probably struggled with, which was where to put this need for increased well credits that we have a gap for, and that is this gap of well expenditures that don't qualify under 025 because they're not 3 miles out or you know, they don't meet that strict criteria. And all they're left with is the 023 credit, which is a 20% capital credit. So the goal was, how do we find a place for a 30% credit on well work that yields immediate production benefits, but you want it for capital expenses, you're essentially wanting to go from 20 to 30, and for operating expenses, you want it to go from 0 to 30. And so what we did is, when we looked at it, we found that it was an easier, a better fit in 025, because 023 only covers qualified capital expenditures, and it's a very tightly written statute that deals with capital expenditures only. And if we wanted this new credit to cover also operating expenses, we saw that 025 covered both. So we dropped it into 025. We also saw that it was important to make sure that DNR got the information, and we see that in this bill you've exported the 025 requirements for information sharing into this. We don't have to export since we're already in 025, so that simplifies it a little bit too. In addition, there was this inequity we saw happening where if you're an explorer, and let's say you're at 2.5 miles out instead of 3, you know, you're kind of stuck. And so we wanted to, so what we're able to do is collapse the 3 mile and these infield expenses and meld them together in section 025, a rewrite of 025. So we approached this, the same problem, I think got much the same result, but we're administratively, it might be cleaner to be in 025, and we would just commend that to the committee if they wanted to look at that.
What is, you know, this in the in one we're dealing with, in 023 we're dealing with just cap and OPEX, so we're really talking, if we do both, we're talking more money. So are we, if we include operating, are we throwing, is it more money that can be deducted or less, or it's
well, Chairman Johnson, when we read House Bill 308, it was unclear to us that it was being limited to capital costs.
Okay.
So we actually thought your intent was to pick up the capital.
It was, by the nature of it being an 023.
Okay.
I'm wondering if that was figured in. If you guys, it's the effect's the same. It's just where you place it.
It is
in the statute. Okay, that's right.
The one thing 023 defines capital,
right,
credits. To, in order to get the well work that currently would be considered to be an operating, not a capital credit, you have to change the, you have to kind of carve out a portion of 023 and say for this category 023 is broader. Mm-hmm. And so it is kind of this amalgam within the 023 credit that becomes a bit problematic, because you've kind of attached this extra concept to the side of it. And that's one of the problems that we were facing when we were dealing with this, and it came, 025 provided a cleaner way of expanding that definition for us.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm a little confused, because I think that I remember specifically talking about infield work versus the step out, in that there is no risk. Basically, you know, the pool's underneath you, you know, you're going to do that, so that the trade-off was that the further you step out, the more risk you have, the more credits you need. And now here, what I'm hearing is that now we're going to do in a non-risky area, we're going to do drilling into the existing known pools, basically no risk, and we're proposing not only 30%, an additional 10% on that, plus the, you know, whatever the cost of oil is and the deductions and progressivity and all those things. So we're going to go not only a 30% credit there, but 30% on the operating expenses and deductibility of the operating expense. And it just seems to me that we're talking about a situation in which we're going to be paying, the state is going to be paying well more than 100% of the entire, is going to be crediting, because we're going to have 30% capital, 30% operating credits. On top of that, these are lease expenditures that are going to be deductible at the 25% base rate plus progressivity. And we could be in a situation, if I remember the Gaffney-Klein graphs, we could be in a situation where the state is paying actually more than 100% of these non-risky investments.
Representative Seaton, through the chair.
Commissioner.
025 credits are not additive to 023 credits. They're mutually exclusive of each other. You can't get both. And so what, so under your sort of aggregation of credits, what you have is we're going to provide a 30% credit for well work. You also get to deduct that cost. So you get the 25% plus progressivity. But that's where it stops. There isn't an additional 30% on top of that for it if it was a, or a 20% if it was a qualified capital expenditure. It's one system or the other. And so just getting to the, I think, the premise that you started with, which was that we justified the exploration incentive credit program as being targeted to more risky, more economically challenged projects because of having to risk the ultimate outcome, and that we were trying to incentivize that additional work. And when the question came up, well, what about the infill drilling programs, was, well, they're not comparable generally with regard to that risk profile, as you indicated. And I'm not suggesting that we see it differently now. What I am recognizing is that there is, within a field, a spectrum of potential projects that could be pursued. And those projects are going to have different economics depending upon what your expected cost to reward, your what additional production you might receive from those costs. There are likely, and I'll freely admit, going to be projects that are going to qualify for this credit that would probably proceed without it, that the economics of the project probably are sufficient to have the project go forward whether they got this credit or not. However, the intent of this proposal, and I think it's probably shared with Representative Johnson's proposal here in this bill, is that there are also likely to be a suite of projects that are going to have this credit kick it over a threshold and have it go from a no-go to a go. Those are the ones that we're trying to target. So we are providing, we fully recognize that we are probably providing a benefit that is unnecessary for certain projects to go forward. However, we're focused on the fact that we're going to get other projects off the dime that otherwise wouldn't be there. And the trade-off, we feel, is appropriate given the fact that at the end of the day, they're going to have to actually spend money to earn these credits.
And I'd like to add to that, too. I remember the step out, or whatever you want to call it, slightly different. Yes, it was more risky, but it was also new oil. It was to reach out beyond where we were and to put more oil through the pipe, because that's what we're all about. It's my viewpoint, and I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but anything that puts, that accomplishes that goal, whether it is 3 miles out or in an existing field, is eligible for those credits. And if it puts oil down the pipeline, that's what we're after. And whether it's inside Kuparuk or Prudhoe, it's not necessarily the risk, it's the oil that it puts down the pipeline. So it's a two-part. It's not only the risk, but it's reaching out to get new oil, and this is basically the same thing. These wells are out producing. So, and Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like, they're going to come back with some reanalysis. Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to do is see an analysis of the state participation at some various, I mean, they've provided $100, $76, and something else. If they would provide that based on what the state participation would be in that expenditures in field, no risk, that would be helpful at these higher credit lines.
Yeah. We can provide that.
Yeah, and I want to be careful about saying no risk. I am not a driller or an operator, but I think anytime you set a rig up, there's some risk. Now, you may not, you know, it's not maybe zero. It may not be as great as it is if it's 3 miles out, but I think there's risk in everything they do. The the reason the well is shut in for a reason. So I still think, to say no risk, I would be happy with less risk.
Sure.
But no risk, I don't think. I don't think you set a rig up anywhere with no risk. Representative Fittenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure you're talking about setting a full drilling rig up. You're talking about setting up on some of these rework activities. You're talking about a little work crew and recracking and logging and doing those things. And that was your answers and Representative Seaton's questions were kind of right on my mark as well. A lot of these things they're going to do anyway, because it's in their economic interest, regardless of tax credits or incentives or whatever they do. Is there a way of separating out those fields? I mean, I've got too much experience up there knowing what they look like and the difference between all of them. They normally do a lot of work on these wells over the course of time regardless. They recrack them. And we've heard many times that the difference between different owners, you know, requires a lot more logging sometimes of what goes on up there because they're competing against each other for what happens. Is there a way that we could make this that it's only for those that actually need an incentive, not just those that, you know, I mean, everything out of 3 miles, you know, it's a good point. Those things that are, you know, right next to the flow stations or the gathering standards or you know, all the different facilities that don't require anything, but
I'll take this one. Personal bill draftings, 19th. Do you want to introduce that? I'd be happy to do it. That's not what we're talking about here. I don't think if it were the case that they'd do it anyway, they'd be doing it. They are not. We're at $70 oil. They are not. Why?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that's true. They have a lot of these things on schedule. Those are the things I'm talking about. The things that are on their normal maintenance schedule, relogging, recracking, recasing, they're doing that anyway.
We'll hear from the producers about that. I think you may be surprised.
Nothing the producers say surprises me.
I appreciate that, and you're probably not going to believe what they say anyway, so that's probably just an academic argument. Commissioner?
Okay. No, I'm fine. Chairman Johnson, one question that we had on the committee substitute was in the section that defines what is a well-related expenditure, and it was the very last clause up to the flange connecting the wellhead to the well line, and we were unclear if that modifier was referencing only the intangible drilling and development costs or whether it also reached up and was a qualifier on any of the other listed well-related activities. And so
it's the intention that it's the well activity, not beyond the well. So it's setting the rig up, okay. not the pipeline that might be need to be redone or any of the other stuff. It's strictly the well workover expenditure.
And that's helpful. I think what threw us off was the well-related seismic work, which may not involve that. So there may be some drafting finesse that could be done there to clarify that. The last issue was the statute of limitation change for production tax assessments. And we wanted to point out, just for the purposes of the interest of this committee, where we are right now as far as our audit status. We currently have 8 PPT/ACE audits in progress that deal with the time period April through December of 2006. We estimate to have those completed by the end of March. We have 2 of the PPT ACES audits pending from the 2006 year, which will go beyond that date. We have 1 ELF audit still in process from the 2003-04-05 time period that through taxpayer extensions and difficulty getting information, et cetera, has extended beyond all the other audits from that time period. And finally, one of the things that the committee may not be aware of is we also have the challenge of auditing the credits. And so now with the passage of ACES and PPT, in addition to just doing the base tax return, we have to audit the credits that have been bestowed under the various programs, which interestingly, out of our 11 auditors right now, we have 4 dedicated full-time to just auditing credits. We have 6, soon to add a 7th auditor, that are focused on production tax returns, and then 2 empty positions.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marcy, when you're doing these audits, which go back quite a few years, do you feel that it's going to have a negative or a positive impact, like in general fund? Or are we going to end up owing money, or are we going to be making money on this, or is this money put into the general fund, I guess, not making money?
Chairman Newman, speaking generally, most audits usually result in some increase in tax payment to the state.
Follow up.
Representative Newman.
Thank you. And that's kind of, where do we see that when we're getting these audits like this? Because I know right now we're going through the budget review processes, and we look at this, and we look at expenditures to the cost of operating and such. And so will you get more positive income back into this? I know all the money goes into the general fund and gets split out or not. How does all that work?
Actually, Chairman Newman, the money that we get from settlements off of audits and resolutions, I believe, goes into the CBR.
Okay. Good. So then,
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, if there's deficits or they come out, the state owing that's just taken back out of CBR. So that's kind of the fund where everything's moved back and forth. I'm getting to a yes and a no.
I'm not sure if somebody from the division wants to speak to this, but I am not aware of many times when an audit resulted in a repayment of a taxpayer. Usually the taxpayer pushes the definition to their advantage, and the conflict moves in the direction of what the state can justify to bring back. If there is a necessity to repay a taxpayer, it would have to be appropriated by the legislature. It would not be something that the department would do on our own.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gutenberg. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Paul. I didn't see.
Okay. On the timeline on audits, we came in with the audit number from you guys the last time, and we authorized you to hire more auditors at a premium salary range. Yeah. Would more auditors allow you to decrease the time to 3 years? Does it work that way?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, the authorization we had to hire in terms of auditors were master auditors, and those individuals through the statutory framework are not supposed to be doing audits but supervising audits.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got what we need in terms of supervisors, master auditors. What we need now are the worker bees, and our challenge is simply being able to attract qualified auditors with oil and gas experience who can step in and immediately take off and do these high-level complicated audits. Generally, what we can attract are beginning level individuals that we have to train up through our system, and so what we're using is our credit audits is a kind of a growing ground to elevate their skill sets and their skill levels and get them there. So, and as I said, when we get them really good, they usually go off somewhere else to work. But but we still have a dedicated group of people who have hung with us, and we depend heavily on.
I'd be careful with the term hung.
Yeah.
Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up. So the time, here we've got all taxpayers on the bottom, 07, 08, not even started.
Yes.
Talk about the timeline. They submitted their tax for the previous year, and something triggers an audit, or they don't automatically. And is this just your time that's delaying this, or is it just you're waiting for industry responses?
Representative Gutenberg, it's a combination of both. We basically get after the immediate ones because we see the limit coming up on some of the older ones, like, for instance, some of the ones back in the ELF time where the statute didn't change. But by and large, we are driven by information gathering. And as I'll go to the next slide and show, the audit information that's required to do an audit under ACES is substantially more expansive than it is for the prior tax type under ELF. Because the slide, I wanted one slide, so I had to compress it. But that one bullet point, lease expenditures, which covers CapEx, all of the capital expenditures, all of the operating expenditures, all of the joint operating agreements, tracking what are the overhead charges, the pipeline tariffs, the marine transportation. A lot of these things are unique to ACES. And then add in all the credits we have to audit. to roll up and then apply against the tax bill. The capital credits, the exploration credits, old tie credits, net operating loss, carry forward credits, assigned credits, where we have to verify, you know, the transfer of the credits. There's a tremendous amount of work that now goes into doing an audit, way more than used to be under ELF. And so that was the reason for asking for the extended statute of limitation from 3 to 6 years when ACES was first passed. And so if this provision here, rolling back the statute of limitations, went from 6 to 3, we most definitely would require additional oil and gas tax auditors to be able to complete the work in the time frame required. But in answer to the other question, yes, it's a combination of staff, but it's almost an equal combination of taxpayers needing to pull together all of this data and this information for the audit. And we are very driven to try to stay within that 2-3 year time frame of staleness, because we recognize taxpayers, it costs them money to keep records around. And so we try to get after it before it's too stale and witnesses' memories have gone faded. But it takes a while, once you've got the data, to digest it, analyze it, have your discussions with the taxpayer, the back and forth for clarification. Mm-hmm. So that takes you from the 3 to the 4, 4.5, 5 year time frame to wrap up, conclude a tax audit, once you've gotten all your hands on the information.
Mr. Chair, just
Representative Gutenberg.
So would this force you to just start an audit if you were at the 3 year point, just to begin it and say you're starting an audit, just to make sure something didn't lapse and get away from you?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, this statute of limitations doesn't require us to begin an audit. It requires us to conclude an audit within the 3 year time frame, because at the conclusion of the audit is when you would make your assessment of what you believe the tax bill truly should be. So it would, if we have a 3 year drop dead time frame, we definitely would be forced to scramble as best we could, because we could not risk loss of value to the state. And it would essentially shift all of the battleground from what is more of a cooperative effort and getting at data and getting the facts into the confrontational phase, which is we would issue an assessment in which we wouldn't have all the data we needed, the taxpayer hadn't been able to locate the data we needed, and we would just say, okay, the burden's on you, here's your tax bill. We'd shift into an appeal phase, so we'd need more hearing officers, and we'd also probably end up with a lot more litigation and the litigation costs.
What is, if I may, Mr. Chair,
so
right now, what is the average time that an audit takes?
Gary, are you still there?
Mr. Chairman, yes, and I could not hear the question.
The question was, right now, what is the average time period for an audit to be begun and completed on the production tax side? And identify yourself for the record.
This is Gary Rogers with the Tax Division. Through the chair, I'm sitting here with a couple other folks, the director and some of the audit masters. I don't know, an audit, once you get all the information, it can take you a year or more to do, but like you indicated, it takes a long time to get the information, digest it, process it, rerun calculations, discuss those with the taxpayer, go back and forth, get more information. You know, it takes years to do these audits.
John, are you there?
Yeah, this is John Iverson, Director of the Tax Division. For the record, Mr. Chairman, I think Gary's right. I mean, I think one of the complications here, and you when you discussed this with the lease expenditures, you know, the bullet points on your slide, just in counting bullet points, I think you're looking at roughly double on the bullets between the audit information required under ELF versus ACES. But what that really represents is under ACES is 3 to 5 times more information that's needed. It's not just double. And under the ELF system that was in place before PPT was passed, those audits were taking roughly 3 years after having had people who had 15 to 20 years of experience auditing them. We have a very inexperienced staff by and large. Now, they're, granted, they're obviously, very intelligent people who are learning very quickly, but We've had folks retire and get higher professional growth in the division.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to see if this was clear to me. With the, this clear, and
clear.
It's kind of confusing.
The equitable share.
That was your words.
Oh, yes, confusing. That's right.
clear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question. So is the problem, would it help if the they're not, sounds like they're just not getting the information back soon enough. Do we need to do something about that, or?
Well, Representative Wilson, you do touch on one of my concerns, is that right now our entire tax system is manual. In other words, documents come in. We've endeavored to have an online filing, and we've got the tax form out that'll be used next year. It's approximately 55 pages of an Excel spreadsheet that all the oil companies right now are struggling to try to figure out how to interface with our antiquated system. But once it comes into our system, literally it's an Excel spreadsheet with a bunch of data lines, and we have to search through that to find things. There's nothing automated which kicks out CapEx, OpEx, credits. You know, it doesn't flow neatly, so that there's not an ease for review by auditors. They have to start with a very big mess. And right now, you know, that's what we've dealt with for the system. So as far as information flow, having an automated system would help with the information sharing. That would be an important key part. And then other than that, it's simply making sure that we launch the audit in it at least within 2 years or so that we can at least begin to get data while it's fresh and not stale, and then have ample time to exchange it with the taxpayer. Because some of the information now is lying outside of Alaska. It's in headquarters, it's in locations where they've centralized their accounting systems and their tax systems, et cetera.
Representative Wilson?
Just a follow-up. How much what are we talking about to get you guys an automated system? That's
well, it had been in prior year appropriation requests, and at that time I think the last one was around $30-35 million. In the budget,
3 to 5 or 35?
35 million.
We'll make sure
that would automate all of the tax types, so that fisheries, all the other folks would be able to have online filing and interface with the systems. But what we've done is we are undertaking in our budget, the governor's budget this year is $300,000 to study how we would go about getting an automated system. So that part is in the budget for our supplemental budget or the fiscal year 11 budget. I'm not sure which. One thing I did want to mention is that DNR has 6 years to do their audits on the royalty side. So essentially, a substantially leaner, smaller set of information that they have to review. And they've got 6 years, and we've got way more stuff to do, and we're happy to have our 6-year statute of limitation.
We'll probably talk to them when they may have a different issue, and they may say different. They may have a different story, and you say have a lot more to
do.
I appreciate, and I would personally support. I don't know what happened to the money in the past. I don't know where it went. I don't know if it was legislature taken out or what happened to it. I really don't care. But when you're talking about a department that's responsible for 85%. Of our budget, and are basically probably more of that of our economic engine in the state, I don't think it's unreasonable for you to have a reliable computer system. A question on audits: how many do you audit everyone?
Chairman Johnson, no, we do not.
What is it? Is it like the IRS, and there's some magic formula that you can't share because there's people in the room and you don't want them to know?
That's probably accurate.
Okay. Can you give me? I mean, we can find out what percentage the IRS says they do 3%, 5%.
It depends on the tax type, because we clearly are trying to make sure that the lion's share of the revenue coming in is accurate.
If and I know you're going to love this statement, if every time you do an audit it results in more money, why don't we audit everyone?
We don't have the staff to do that, sir.
Would it make sense to have the staff to do that? How much money are we talking? I know that there's people in the back of the room who just fell out of the chair, by the way. So,
I mean, if I'm weighing into this carefully.
Representative Johnson? Really, if we, every time we do an audit, we make more money, does it make sense for us to audit everything? And then we just, when it comes in, we start the audit process. And does that, would that pay for additional staff? Would that tighten up our taxes? Is that a better way to go than just randomly doing it and let's staff up and let's do the job?
Representative Johnson, to the chair, like many things, if you think about the 80-20 rule, that with 20% of the effort, we may be able to get 80% of the results. I think the question for us in terms of responding to you on that matter is making sure that we are requesting and providing you with a picture of where we believe we can get the best return for the additional expenditure. Excuse the analogy, but right. But similar to the question of how a tax system relates to investment, there are a number of different factors that would go into the ability of just giving us more staff and more appropriation in having more audits and more effective audits.
Commissioner, let me get you off the hook. I am not interested in auditing every audit. I guess, are we being efficient in what we're doing, that it takes us 6 years? Are there ways we can streamline it? I know DNR does it, and the IRS does 7 years, but they have how many, 300 million, and we have seven companies? In my humble opinion, we should be a better, it's 80% of our budget, we should be better. If we can't, I'm comfortable with that. And what I'd like to do is just some justification. You started down that road. I don't think we need to finish this up tonight, but if it needs to be 8 years and you can justify it, that's fine. If we can do it in two, we owe that to our clients and our partners to do that. So somewhere there's a number. Is six it? And you don't have to answer that now, because we're 5 minutes later than I told people we would. I apologize to the Department of Labor. I know it's been laborious. And I think we had some other people. I don't even have the list anymore. But with that,
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, I just want to go back. There was some question with regard to the presentation materials as it relates to the hiring percentage issue, and when it was clarified that this rebate applied to the base tax, not to the
all time,
then it caused us to rethink, okay, did we do anything wrong here? And in retrospect, the numbers on these slides are valid. These are basically representations of potential company situations, are not intended to be actual, you know, any similarities right to real or there's strictly coincidental.
Can I go through and explain what it is then?
Yeah. Let me have Marcia talk about this.
Essentially, the reason it's we're okay with our calculations is on the top. Do you have a pointer? On the top table on the far right side, current tax liability before rebate. Just assume that that's been calculated appropriately with the rebate going against the base only. And so what we did is we imagined three different companies. One, company A is small, company B is medium-sized, company C is large, and you'll see down below in the second table, bottom half of the table. Company A, for instance, currently has a workforce of 87%, and they want to get to 87.5%. just to get over that edge. So they're currently enjoying a 6% rebate, so their current tax rebate is $6 million. If they get up to the 87.5, they'll get $8 million in rebate, so it'd be an increase in $2 million, and they've got to add a certain number of employees to do it. We did that with each of the companies. We took them, company B is at currently 82% workforce. If they go to 82.5, they will essentially get an additional $10 million. Company C is,
and that would be the additional 29 employees, is that?
That's correct, an additional 29 employees. And company C is at 79.5, so we put them below the line. They currently have no rebate, but if they are able to get up to 80%, then they would essentially achieve a $30 million rebate, and they would need to add 50 employees to do that.
And just the, when we say number of employees needed, that means hiring Alaskans that currently would are not part of their labor pool and would just add to their existing labor pool. We're not saying they would substitute for out-of-state workers. That would be a potentially lower number that would make that change.
Yeah, we're not assuming any firing is what we're doing.
There will be firing.
So I don't want to spend a lot of time on these slides other than just to point out how to read it. Essentially, what this tells you is the minimum. This is the least that the rebate would be on the chart. And if you look at it and you'd say, well, if company A were moving from 87.5 to 90%, then they would add 20 employees and it would cost about $19,000 per employee. That sounds like a pretty good deal. But if and this is where we extrapolate, it could be anywhere from 2 million to that number, depending upon how close they are to the line. So this is that we were getting at the tier situation, right, and the discussion about whether it'd be better to do a linear, you know, if there's a way to draft it.
If there's a way to draft it, I'm certainly not.
It would avoid the inequities on either end of the line is really all that this demonstrates.
As long as we don't penalize somebody or deter someone from going to 82 to 85.
Exactly.
You know, we want to make a benefit. I would like to see every employee hired a benefit. So maybe Mr. or Representative Seaton's way is the right way to go.
Right. And that's all we were just trying to show with the slide, sir.
Thank you. Is there anything else? Any questions? Anything you want to add before we bring you back?
Well, I'd be to answer questions or to provide additional materials, and I assume we'll have other bills up before you or CS on this one.
Yeah, and I do want to work with you on some of the finer points and making sure that the things we agree on we ought to move on, and we ought to wrestle about the things we don't agree on and try to make them at least as palatable to the administration and as we can before we try to move on.
Sounds great.
And I appreciate your good work. Apologize for those that didn't make it. Any additional questions before we close? I appreciate the committee staying. Like I said, we don't want this to tie up all the committee work forever, but I do exercise a prerogative of the chair at times. Representative Seaton?
And Mr. Chairman, they have the questions we ask about calculation of those numbers. So.
Right. I'm assuming they do, and I see them shaking their head. And I'll work with you, and we'll set up a time. And Commissioner, should I work with you or Marcia or someone else in your office?
Either one of us.
Okay.
We'll both be around here a lot, I think.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I know there are people online listening. We haven't started public testimony. We're away from that, so I appreciate it. With that, at 4:10, we are adjourned.